Smuggler's Grift, written by B.Z. Kelly, narrated by B.Z. Kelly. Copyright 2014, B.Z. Kelly. This is a work of fiction. Names, characters, businesses, places, events, and incidents are either the products of the author's imagination or used in a fictitious manner. Any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, or actual events is purely coincidental. Dedicated to my muse, Andrea. Chapter 1. My seat felt soggy from the heat of the day. I was relieved that the cool ocean breeze now dominated as the sun set on the tiny Villa Acuña Airport. It would likely be the wee hours of the morning before my client, Manuel, returned to the aircraft for the trip back to Florida. I was fine with that. I would need daylight before I could land at my unlit farmer's field back in the States anyway. The Army taught me to fly C-47s during the Second War to end all wars, and for that I am grateful. I'm not keen on the idea of working for others. My trusty military surplus C-47, called a DC-3 in civilian trim, allows me to make a comfortable living and be my own boss. Although based on the same airframe, it seems to me like classic bureaucratic ignorance to call my aircraft a DC-3. My DC-3 retains the large cargo door and reinforced cargo floor of the C-47. My aircraft still has a glider tow hook installed in the tail. The superchargers and water injection were removed by the Army prior to sale, but I don't mind. The flying I plan on doing now is primarily low and slow. There's no need to spend more money on fuel than necessary. Last year, I had an airport charge me 33 cents a gallon. As delivered by the military, with its two Wright R1829 cylinder radial engines, my trusty steed uses less than 100 gallons per hour. I call her Pegasus. Since I usually fly lightly loaded, I can stretch my range to more than 1,200 miles on full wing tanks. Even better, my C-47 still has most of the cabin tanks in place, allowing me to hold enough fuel to stay airborne for 16 hours or more if needed. Cargo, my faithful black lab, sat in the pilot seat. His nose was out the open left window, keeping watch and smell. Since I now fly alone, I sit in the co-pilot seat. Controls for the cowl flaps and circuit breakers are located only on the right side. While intended to be flown by two, the Douglas design is so easy to fly that I have no issues flying her alone from the co-pilot seat on the right. Since the war, I tend not to get close to people. Cargo came aboard one day a couple of years ago, and I could not get him to disembark. I couldn't wait, so I took off with him still on board. He enjoyed the ride, and he's been by my side ever since. I added a length of carpet to help him climb the slippery cargo floor up to the cockpit. I tell any clients that fly with me, the carpet is to help them climb up the cargo floor in their street shoes. It does help folks walk up the inclined floor of a parked DC-3, but I didn't put the carpet in until cargo came aboard. During the war, I flew a few extra items with my good friend Eric Einar. We flew the hump, ferrying supplies to isolated troops in China, and both survived it. After that mission, there were always requests to transport goods quietly, and Eric was the master of the deal in that regard. Eric was a tall blonde of Swedish descent. He was a few inches taller than my 6 feet, and he married a stunning Swedish beauty before he went off to war. Saga joined us in the Pacific after the hump and worked with Eric to put together some very lucrative deals. Everyone called her Sage. I just wanted to do my duty and fly, but Sage was quite persuasive. I had also seen what Sage had not. More than 500 aircraft went down during that cargo lift. We were just carrying supplies. It was not supposed to be that hazardous. We prevailed, but it all seemed like such a waste. Sage convinced me to fly with Eric on some missions that are not recorded in the books. Why not, I figured. War changes men. It changed me. Eric told me that Saga means seeing one, and that Einar means lone warrior. Both fit Sage perfectly. She reminds me of Ingrid Bergman, her bright blue eyes always moving, always aware. Her greatest weapon is being underestimated. Eric was killed by an anti-aircraft round. I was in the pilot seat when it struck. He was flying co-pilot. Eric was senior to me in time and rank. We usually flew the other way round, with Eric in the pilot seat, but Eric was a generous fellow that way. He was letting me build some time as captain, in command of the ship. War is so often like that. My first thought was, it should have been me in that seat. Of course, whether the round came through the right or the left was purely the flip of a coin. I felt guilty, But Sage never blamed me. My right arm took shrapnel when Eric was hit. I was able to fly the plane back with one good arm and land it. They gave me a purple heart and a bronze star. Suddenly, I was Brody Malone, war hero. I hated the attention. The award stated some nonsense about the Army's precious cargo. The only thing I had done was save my own behind. I could not save Eric. He could not hold on until we landed. I had never exactly been a people person before the war, but after that I became more of a loner. The few friends I have took to calling me Loner, an abbreviation of my last name. Everyone assumed when Eric was killed that Sage would fade away. They didn't know Sage. She became an independent operator. She became very self-sufficient. We remained trusted friends, with a bond forged in the way that only war can. We kept a certain emotional distance, however, perhaps because she was the widow of my best friend in the war, although she seems to keep her emotional distance from men in general after losing Eric. It's hard for me to tell why, but it's certainly another loss caused by the war. Sage is the most beautiful woman I ever laid eyes on. The only reason for her to be single is by her choice. After the war, she helped me finance Pegasus and brought me business. Sage sets up the deals and handles the money. All I have to do is fly. Sage is the only one I trust as much as cargo. She honors my rules, rules that others scoff at because they don't understand. I don't fly drugs. There are many smugglers that fly drugs, but I don't trust them. No people get hurt, at least not as part of the plan. I'll use my Colt 1911 if I have to, but it's strictly a last resort. Also, I don't consider governments people. The way I see it, I do absolutely nothing wrong. I sleep very well at night, but I realize others have a different perspective on my work. I'm okay with that. You can't please everyone. The stars came out after sunset. There was only a partial moon. Cargo remained vigilant, occasionally looking back at me to gauge my level of concern. I turned on the shortwave radio I installed in Pegasus for unofficial communication. It has a setting for standard AM radio stations. I found Tito Puente's new album, Mambarama, being played in full. I like Cuban jazz. A cold beer would have tasted great right about now, but I had a job to do. I rolled up a blanket, always on board, and used it as a pillow, resting it up against the frame of the right window. I could smell the salt in the ocean breeze. I love that smell. The Villa Acuña Airport does not get much traffic. In fact, it's not much of an airport. It consists of an unlit dirt runway on an island south of Cuba's mainland. It's ideal for my purposes, however. I can usually land for a while and take off again without seeing anyone. It typically is only used for flying out sugarcane after the harvest. The harvest is done for the year. The airfield won't be used again until spring. Sage pays the right official to help ensure that little attention is paid. It's an uncontrolled airfield with no control tower and no record of flights coming or going. Most air traffic goes directly to the Havana airport on the mainland. Havana certainly would have shortened the trip for Manuel, but if he wanted a short trip time, he could have chosen from any of a dozen commercial flights. Manuel wanted to slip into Cuba, gamble, and slip back out again. He wanted no record of his arrival or departure, and no record of his quote-unquote wife that accompanied him. So instead, Manuel met me at a remote farmer's field, about an hour west of Miami by car, on the edge of the Everglades. Pegasus was waiting with a load of medical supplies to be delivered. The medical supplies were just a cover story should anyone inquire. They usually did not inquire here at Villa Acuña. The same cases of cognac had been in Pegasus for 3 trips now. We took off at first light. For the first half hour we flew at 800 feet of altitude over the Everglades. I had my window open and my elbow resting on it to keep cool. Then out over the ocean for a bit, before climbing up to 4,000 feet to cool off and cruise at 160 miles an hour to Villa Acuña. A direct route would have taken less than 2 hours, but we flew around the Cuban mainland rather than over it. Our longer 500-mile route took just over 3 hours. We had good weather and were able to set down on Villa Acuña. If the visibility had been poor or the crosswind too high, we would have had to divert to the island airport of Nueva Gerona or return home. The medical supplies would have certainly come in handy if we had landed at Nueva Gerona. I prefer to land at more remote fields, though. I don't trust people that take bribes. I had taxied to the northwest corner of the Villa Acuña field and parked Pegasus with a clear view of the only runway and the road leading to it. Manuel had arranged for his transportation from here to Havana, a Apparently, he grew up in Cuba and still had strong connections there. While Manuel and his bride went off to the casino, I made sure Pegasus was ready for the return trip. In the very tail of the cargo area were five yellow jerry cans, just like the cans used to carry gasoline, but these cans carried 5 gallons of oil instead. All except for 2 cans, that is. I kept olive drab paint in 1 can and alcohol in the other. I took a 5-gallon can of oil and climbed up on the wing. During the war, it was common for one mechanic to simply jump up on the wing and another mechanic to hand up the oil can. Flying solo, I had to dig out the steps and climb them like an old man. I dragged the oil can up onto each wing and topped off each engine with oil. This morning, each engine had used nearly 2 gallons of oil on the flight over. The old radials were thirsty that way, but let's see one of those fancy new jets land in a farmer's field. Once the oil was added and the can stowed again and back, I put pins into the landing gear. I didn't know how long I might sit here, and it would make a hasty exit difficult if the hydraulics bled down and Pegasus were to drop a wing on the ground. Pins were usually added to the ailerons, elevator, and rudder, too. But since I was going to stay with the aircraft, I left these out. As long as the wind stayed light, I wouldn't need them. If I had to, I could take off with the pins still in the landing gear. The plane would just fly slower with the gear down. The winds were light, so I didn't bother with wheel chocks either. The last thing to do was a pre-flight check from the cockpit. All the electrical systems looked good. I had no warning lights. Jake, my mechanic back in the States, did a great job of keeping Pegasus airworthy and reliable. I was often in places where aircraft repair was, shall we say, inconvenient. As the 10 o'clock hour approached, I had not seen any activity at Villa Acuña for more than 3 hours. I made sure cargo was on alert, turned the radio off, and settled in for a nap. A cool, salty breeze drifted through the cockpit. I rested my head on the rolled-up blanket. It was around 5 o'clock in the morning when cargo woke me with a quiet, ruff, ruff. The night was clear, and I could make out a vehicle slowly moving along the far end of the runway. I climbed from the co-pilot seat, stowed the blanket, and stepped between the seats to the rear of the cockpit. I took my 1911 from its pocket on the right side of the co-pilot seat and stuffed it in my waistband at the small of my back, allowing my untucked shirt to fall over it. I liked Manuel, but like and trust are two entirely different concepts. Cargo and I then made our way through the cockpit door into the cargo area. I paused to stretch. Just behind the cockpit were 4 100-gallon cabin tanks on each side of the aisle. Just behind the 8 cabin tanks were 4 jump seats, 2 on either side. I rarely carried more than 2 passengers, so this arrangement worked out quite well. Behind the jump seats, on the right side of the aircraft, opposite the cargo door, was my 1939 Indian Sport Scout. The engine had been rebuilt a few times. The paint was now just black, with no sign of the original mustard yellow color. It had no front fender, which was a bit messy when riding in dirt, but it was better than walking. I opened the cargo door and lowered the steps. Cargo and I then made our way down to ground level. We went around the tail of the plane to the side that was facing the runway. I stood with a casual, military bearing. I didn't want to seem unprofessional, but I had no interest in becoming buddy-buddy with my clients. I figured a casual military bearing struck the right balance. I stood near the tail facing the front of the aircraft. My feet were shoulder-width apart. My hands were behind me, my right wrist gently pressing the 1911 into the small of my back. Cargo sat to my right, his front legs straight from shoulders to the ground, his head alert. I noted the wind direction. The breeze was light, coming from the east. All I would need to do was taxi onto the end of the runway I was parked near and take off headed east. I looked up into the south sky and noted the position of the first constellation to catch my eye, Orion. If I put Orion at my 2 o'clock, I should be pretty well lined up with the runway. A black 1941 Mercury rolled up, its headlights coming directly at me for a moment, then turning and illuminating some trees off in the distance as it came to a stop. Manuel stepped out of the right rear door and turned to help his, quote-unquote, wife out. He was wearing a cream, white, 3-piece suit that his solid frame filled completely. She had on a white dress with red lace that came down just below the knee. The red trim of her dress matched her red high heels. In those heels, she was a bit taller than Manuel. If neither one made any adjustments, she would kiss him right on the nose. When they were both solidly on their feet, he turned and said heartily, "Señor Malone! Good to see you."
"Good to see you," I politely replied.
Manuel leaned in through the passenger door window of the Mercury and spoke some quiet Spanish that I couldn't make out. The car then drove off, and we made our way in the dim moonlight around the tail of the aircraft to the steps and up into the cargo area. The couple had clearly had a good time. They were in good spirits, were talking loudly, and were just a bit unsteady on their feet. I helped them up the steps. Manuel's nameless wife took off her heels to walk up the inclined carpet to the jump seat on the left. I pulled the steps up, closed the cargo door, and made my way to the cockpit with cargo following along behind. I paused at their jump seats to make sure they were comfortable and settled in. Manuel took my hand in both of his and said, "You are my favorite pilot, Señor Malone. Thank you. We had a great time at the Gran." "You're welcome," I said, figuring the alcohol had made him sentimental. I had never asked what casino he went to. I assumed he was talking about the Gran Casino Nacional. I'd been there, a bit extravagant for my taste, with fountains and sculptures sprinkled throughout. It was not a bad place to play poker, though. Rich men, it seems, often overestimate their abilities at a card table. I then climbed through the cockpit door and into the right seat after closing the left window. I wouldn't be able to reach that window to close it once we were in the air. At 8,000 feet, it would get mighty cold and drafty if I left it open. When we're in the air, cargo rides behind the left seat on the floor. He would have no need for an open window. Once I'd settled into the right seat, I looked over my left shoulder to check on the passengers. I'd left the cockpit door open so I could keep an eye on them. They were preoccupied with each other, so I took the 1911 from my waistband and stashed it in the pocket on the right side of the seat. So I took my 1911 from my waistband and stashed it in the pocket on the right side of the seat. I would be in this seat for more than 3 hours, and I wanted to be as comfortable as possible. It was then I noticed the red tag on my control yoke. It was my reminder that I still had pins in my landing gear that would prevent it from retracting. That's what I get for taking a nap and trying to wake up just before takeoff. Oh well, better to catch it now than realize I can't retract the wheels over the ocean. I slipped the 1911 back into my waistband, motioned for cargo to stay, and made my way back to the cargo door. I apologized for the slight delay as I passed Manuel. I opened the cargo door and considered jumping down, but thought better of it. My legs are not as durable as they once were. I lowered the steps, climbed down, removed the pins, and returned. I secured the cargo door and returned to the cockpit. Manuel and his wife were still enjoying themselves, and there was no sign of activity at Villa Acuña. I once again slipped the 1911 into its pocket by the seat. A few minutes after 5 o'clock in the morning, I cranked the left engine and hit the mag to bring it to life. Then I cranked the right engine and hit its mag to bring it to life. Oil pressure's good. Temperature's coming up nicely. What could possibly go wrong? End of chapter one. Chapter two. One last scan of the field showed no sign of activity. If you were taking off by the book at this uncontrolled airport, you would turn the radio to 123.0 and announce your intentions. I didn't exactly fly by the book, however. I put on the headphones and listened to 123.0 while the engines came up to operating temperature. I heard no sign of an approaching aircraft, so I decided to taxi out. With my feet resting on the rudder pedals, I advanced the mixture controls nearest me to full rich. I made sure the cowl flaps were open. These settings keep the engines cool during takeoff. Reaching left, next to the pilot seat, I advanced the two prop pitch levers to flying position. Then I advanced the throttles in the middle, right between both seats. I rolled toward the runway. It was dark, but the stars gave me some orientation. I taxied to the end of the runway and turned until Orion was at my 2 o'clock. Once the tail was up and flying, I could turn on the wing-mounted landing lights and finish the takeoff with a view of the runway. I engaged the tail wheel lock and wiggled the rudder back and forth to make sure it was locked in. Then I applied power for takeoff. If I was fully loaded, I would have advanced the throttles to 52 inches of mercury for maximum power without overstressing the engines. Lightly loaded as I was, I advanced the throttles until I saw 47 inches and left them there. It was more important to keep her straight down the runway. The two 9-cylinder radials roared to life. A slight difference in their RPM created a familiar pulsing to the roar. With my window open, the blast of salty ocean air came into the cockpit and mixed with the smell of oil inside the DC-3. As I accelerated down the runway, the tail rose up and I turned on the landing lights. I was just a bit to the left of the runway and corrected my course. Once back On the middle of the runway, I turned the landing lights back off. There was no need to sweep a spotlight across the sky as I took to the air. The vibration level suddenly dropped as my wheels left the runway. I climbed up into the sky, set the cowl flaps to trailing, and retracted the landing gear. Leveling off at 800 feet, I turned west, southwest, and headed out for clear water. My eyes went from scanning the horizon for lights of ships to the artificial horizon in front of me. I took off my headphones and stuck my right elbow on the window's edge. With the window open, it was too noisy to hear the radio, but I didn't want to talk to anyone anyway. The cool air was refreshing, but I was still a bit tense. No matter how many trips I take, I never start to relax until I'm more than halfway home. I spotted a ship at my 2 o'clock. I didn't expect any issues from the Cuban Navy, but it's always best to attract minimal attention to yourself in my line of work. I turned further south, heading further out into the open ocean, before flying around the Cuban mainland. After an hour, the sun began to rise. It was much easier to fly looking out the window at the real horizon than staring at the gauge in front of me. With the sun, however, came a glimpse of ominous skies. Looking north, I saw nothing but a line of clouds and dark skies. Looking east and west, I could not see around the storm. I would need to fly directly through it. I slid my window closed and began to steadily climb up to 8,000 feet. I wanted some extra altitude in case the storm caused a sudden drop. As a side benefit, Manuel and his companion would not remember the rough part of the trip. If you have one drink, it feels like five when a plane climbs up to 8,000 feet. If you have more than that, and I was pretty certain they both had, then sleep was pretty certain when you got up to altitude. That's why I never drink before flying. I leveled off at 8,500 feet and set my cowl flaps to closed to keep heat in the radial engines. Looking back over my shoulder, I could just make out my passengers in the early daylight. They were sleeping soundly. I was glad the jump seats had seat belts. Cargo looked up at me, then lay his head back down and went back to sleep on his pad. The altitude did not seem to bother him at all. I braced myself for the rough ride through the storm. I lowered my landing gear to stabilize the aircraft. I wanted to slow down a bit anyway, so losing some speed was no problem. Lowering the heavy landing gear lowered the center of gravity and helped the aircraft keep its wings a bit more level in very turbulent air. I reduced my airspeed to 120 miles an hour. It began to rain. Streams of water streaked across the windshield and past the windows. It made the cockpit as loud as it had been with the window open. Cargo woke up and watched me closely. Flashes of lightning lit up the clouds. The sky looked like cream poured into a light gray coffee. I aimed for a spot of sky with fewer flashes and paid close attention to my airspeed and artificial horizon. The ride was pretty smooth until it wasn't. Suddenly, it was like we were in a free fall. I pulled back on the yoke and it made little difference. We dropped to 4,000 feet, and then suddenly we started to rise. I looked out at the wings and could see them clearly flexing. I had been in weather like this with a fully loaded C-47, so I knew Pegasus could stand up to it with a light load. It wasn't going to be a comfortable ride, though. For the next 30 minutes, the plane was tossed about. Its wings were rocked, and its altitude rose and fell from 8,000 feet to 4,000 feet and back again. Cargo was now on his feet to help him ride out the storm. The seat belts were holding my passengers safely in place. I was beginning to think I should have fastened my seat belt. The ride was just beginning to smooth out when a fuel pressure light came on. I found its circuit breaker and cycled it, but the light stayed on. The right engine then sputtered and died. I quickly applied pressure on the left rudder to keep the plane straight and feathered the right engine's prop. We were still being tossed about, but now the oscillations up and down were only a few hundred feet or so. However, with only one engine and the landing gear down, we could not hold our altitude. We drifted down from 7,000 feet to 6,000 feet. I pulled the landing gear back up. I had the left engine set to cruise. I could increase power if necessary, but I figured I would slowly descend first to see what altitude Pegasus could maintain. I found it at 3,500 feet. As the weather cleared, I held 3,500 feet for the next hour as I approached the coast of Florida. Normally, I would come across the Everglades at 800 feet, but with one engine, I wanted some margin. I dropped to 1,500 feet and set across the swamp. Luckily, the weather had cleared again, so I should be able to put down in my farmer's field. Cargo lay back down. I glanced back and noticed Manuel just starting to wake up. I found my field and spotted the windsock. It showed a 10 to 15 mile an hour west wind. Manuel had left his car in the east end of the field. I was going to have to apologize for the walk. With one engine, I would not be able to taxi once I put her down. For me to land into the wind, I would need to land east to west, and I would roll to a stop at the opposite end of the field. But first things first, I needed to get Pegasus down safely. I slowed down gradually. I applied some flaps and lowered the landing gear. I was down to 80 miles an hour as I spied the field and lined up for final approach. My left leg was beginning to get tired from holding left rudder, but we were almost down. I needed to invest in a more comfortable pair of boots, I thought. My approach was a bit high, so I pulled back power to the left engine and feathered the prop. It was going to be easier to treat this like a dead stick landing from here. I put the nose down and then flared at the beginning of the field and touched down. I applied some brakes to bring Pegasus to a stop as soon as possible. That would minimize the walk for Manuel. The tail dropped, and I turned the plane in an arc. We came to rest nearly 2,000 feet from his car. I shut the left engine down, slipped the 1911 back in my waistband, and went to check on my guests. His attractive guest was still groggy, but Manuel was in fine spirits once again. I explained that I had been unable to taxi up to his vehicle.
Señor Malone, my good man, would you be so kind as to fetch the car for us?
Manuel pleaded in his jovial manner. My first reaction was that I'm a pilot, not an errand boy. My second thought was that I didn't want to leave him aboard my aircraft alone. But he did pay good money for the flight, and I could use a walk. I looked around the cargo area and didn't really see anything he could harm. I told Manuel to stay put and motioned with a flat hand to cargo. Cargo responded wonderfully to silent hand gestures. He would not move until I returned. Unless someone entered the cockpit.
Certainly,
I said. Manuel handed me his keys. With cargo guarding the cockpit, I opened the rear cargo door, dropped the steps, and walked across the field to his car. My boots were soon damp and muddy. The rain I had just flown through had passed by here a few hours earlier. It left a clean, after-rain smell hanging over the field. Manuel's car was a brand new 1955 Mercury Montclair convertible. It was teal, with wide white walls, and a white top. It was not a surprising choice for a wealthy playboy. I climbed in, trying to take as little mud with me as possible. I discovered the car had electrically powered windows. Figuring out the switch, I lowered the windows and started up the V8. Unlike my old 1940 Chevy pickup, the car featured an automatic shifting transmission. I moved the shift lever to D, and eased back across the field, pulling up next to the steps leading down from the cargo door. I left the engine running as I got out and climbed the stairs back into the cargo area. I climbed the stairs slowly, with my right hand firmly on my 1911, just in case. Easing my head in, I looked left and saw my two guests laughing and joking, still sitting on the jump seat. Cargo was laying in the cockpit, his head just visible through the cockpit door. I dropped my shirt tail back over the 1911 and climbed up to help my guests. The carpeting helped boots from slipping on the cargo floor, too.
Thank you, Señor Malone, thank you,
Manuel said. Their seat belts were already undone. Manuel rose to help his wife down the cargo ramp, down the steps, and into the car. I followed. Cargo remained in the cockpit. Once they were settled into his car, Manuel lowered the roof.
Thank you for such a smooth ride home, Señor Malone. I hope that we can do business again,
he said, leaning out of the car to show his enthusiasm. Certainly, I nodded. You have Sage's number.
You have a very strange business arrangement, Señor Malone.
I like it, I said, then waved and walked back to Pegasus. I had no interest in continuing this conversation. Manuel's date put a teal print scarf over her hair as they eased back across the field and started on their hour-long journey back to Miami. I watched them until they were out of sight. Then I watched a few minutes more. So I have trust issues. So what? They don't bother me. I could have unloaded the scout and ridden back to my apartment, but it was a long drive. I had done some short runs with cargo aboard the scout, but an hour ride was not practical. It also was bound to attract attention, which is never a good idea in my line of work. Before I spent the rest of my day riding out to pick up my truck and returning to get cargo, I decided to see if I could fix the fuel pump issue. But first, I went to the rear cargo area, unloaded the wing ladder, grabbed a can of oil, and topped off both engines with oil. I still had plenty of fuel to get back to the North Perry Airport, close to my apartment. North Perry was a pretty small airport that was just a dirt field until 1950. It had two runways that allowed me to land in all weather conditions, provided there was enough visibility. Sage was able to procure a private hangar for Pegasus at the North Perry Airport. This not only allowed me to shelter it out of the weather, but it also made it difficult to tell when Pegasus was home and when it was flying. I got some water and food for cargo. I put it out under the left wing. Cargo finished all of his food and took a good long drink before laying down in the shade. I then set about hoping to find a shorted wire that would account for my fuel pressure light. If the pump was bad, I did have a spare in back, but I would have spent the rest of the day replacing it. I climbed up on the right wing and took an inspection panel off the right wing nacelle. I found the bundle of wires that included the fuel pump. Just as I had hoped, I found where this bundle rubbed against a rounded edge. The violence of the storm had caused the bundle to rub up and down. The rubbing finally wore through the insulation and caused a short. I put an excessive quantity of tape around the wire and its bundle. Then I returned to the cockpit and cycled the breaker. No light. Yes! I thrust my right fist up and prepared to fly Pegasus home. I brought cargo back inside and stowed away the oil cans, tools, and steps. I secured the cargo door and made my way back up to the cockpit. Cargo made himself at home, behind the pilot seat. I started the right engine first to make sure it would run. Then I started the left engine. I could now taxi and turn at will. I pulled the 1911 from my waistband and slipped it back into its pocket on the right side of my seat. I taxied back to the east end of the field, where Manuel had parked his teal convertible. I then turned Pegasus into the wind and rolled out. I lifted off and decided to just leave my wheels down for the 20-minute flight to North Perry Airport. I was tired. I climbed to 3,000 feet with the window still open. The cool blast of air felt good. 10 minutes out, I closed the window and put on my headphones so I could speak to the tower at North Perry. I asked the tower to send someone to open my hangar doors. I had left them unlocked. I entered the pattern and landed. As I taxied to my hangar, a mechanic in an old pickup was just pulling up to open my hangar doors. I paused, slid my window open, and gave him a wave of thanks. He waved back, returning to the truck, and left. I pulled straight into the shade of my hangar and shut Pegasus down. Now I could relax. I sat in the co-pilot seat for several minutes, letting the tension flow from my body. I looked over and saw cargo with his head up, watching me. I couldn't suppress a chuckle. "Hey, buddy, ready to go?" I asked. I put on my oiled cotton fedora. I liked my hat. It was broken in, like a pair of well-worn shoes. It shielded me from the sun, as well as the frequent Florida rainstorms. Cargo snapped to his feet and eagerly wagged his tail. I noted the hours for each engine and the airframe, jotting them down on my notepad. Then I tossed my 1911, along with uneaten food, into my gear bag and walked down the carpet. As cargo stood eagerly waiting for me, I opened the cargo door, walked down the steps, and closed the plane up. We walked into the bright sunshine of an early Florida afternoon in June, and I slid the hangar doors shut, snapping a lock on them. Cargo and I then began the mile-long walk to the apartment. Whenever possible, I walked to the hangar. I prefer not to drive. It makes it more difficult for anyone to tell when I'm flying Pegasus. As we walked, I continued to shed my stress. The mission was over. I could return to just being a normal guy. I found a stick and tossed it for cargo. He chased the stick with bounding leaps, still full of energy, returning it to me for more. I felt like I could use a nap and a beer. not necessarily in that order. Business first, however. End of chapter 2. Chapter 3. We walked east on Southwest 12th Street to a small single-story apartment building. It was a typical hot, muggy, Florida afternoon. There are only a half dozen apartments in my building, and it's pretty quiet. My apartment is at the far east end. I entered through the north-facing patio door. Cargo stayed outside in the shade of an awning above the patio. Inside, the heat was stifling. I opened every window there was in the place. After changing into a dry shirt, I grabbed a Ballantine ale from the fridge. I much prefer ales to other kinds of beer. Ballantine in hand, I returned to the patio and sat on the end of a long stone bench with my logbook. The stone felt cool through my khaki slacks. Cargo jumped up on the bench next to me and rested his head on my right thigh. I swear that dog can read my mind. We sat and relaxed, letting the hot air escape from the apartment. As the sun dropped in the sky a bit, the crickets began to chirp. I pet Cargo and savored the beer. I wouldn't be flying for a while. Officially, today's flight was a fly fishing expedition. Since I had pulled the plane from the hangar, I had logged 7 hours, 35 minutes of flight time. Engine run time was 7 hours, 57 minutes. That would be consistent with a fishing location that was about 600 miles away. Examining a chart I keep tucked in my logbook, I looked for a spot 600 miles or so from where Pegasus is stored. Straight over the Gulf is a little fishing spot I know of. It's off the coast of New Orleans. It is 600 miles from North Perry, and I had landed there before. It is a remote site on the beach of an uninhabited island surrounding a small body of water called Fishing Smack Bay. Granted, I landed a Piper Cub there, not a DC-3. However, it should pass as an excuse for my hours. How could they prove I never landed on that island? Besides, it would not be the craziest entry ever made into my log. With my cover as essentially a bush pilot, they have come to expect anything in my log. If the FAA examines my log, they spend more time on whether my engine maintenance is up to date, and of course, whether I've paid all my fees. I finished my log entries around 6 o'clock and loaded cargo into my truck. We set out east toward the coast. A few miles down the road, I spotted a payphone and pulled over to make a call. Sage and I never call each other direct from each other's line. We also do not use each other's names when we speak. Chalk it up to professional paranoia. Hello? Said the voice on the line. Love, I said. Lover, Sage replied, with extra drama thrown in. How are you? Great. I miss you. This is actually code for wanting to meet. See you soon, sweetheart, Sage replied. This is also code. It means we can meet at the usual place in an hour or so. That would be great, I say. Then the operator interrupted, demanding more quarters to continue the call. I hung up. Returning to the truck, Cargo and I headed east toward the coast. Just north of Hollywood, Florida, is a walkway along the intercoastal waterway. It is where Sage and I meet. There's not much around it, except boats traveling the inland route. It also happens to be just a couple of miles north of my favorite watering hole, Duke's. The straight six in my truck clattered along as I headed east on Pines Boulevard. The breeze felt refreshing through my open window. Cargo had his head out the passenger side window, his ears flying in the wind. I crossed over the intercoastal and turned left on North Ocean Drive. A mile up the road, I found a parking spot and pulled in. The sun was getting lower in the sky as Cargo and I began our walk. The breeze was from the west now, so even though we were near the ocean, it was still quite hot. I found a nice railing to lean on while Cargo and I waited for Sage. After a few minutes, I heard footsteps. I did not need to look. I knew the rhythm of her walk. Hello, Brody. Sage greeted me with a low, sultry voice. Hi, Sage. I finally turned to see Sage. She was dressed in very loose-fitting clothes, trying to hide her beauty. She had her blonde hair pulled back in a ponytail, which was sticking out of the back of a ball cap. Her white blouse was floating in the light breeze, as were her white, baggy slacks. Despite the loose fit of the clothes, her stunning figure was still apparent to me. I brought my gaze up to Sage's eyes. They were a stunning blue, and they are always in motion. She briefly looked back at me, then scanned the area for anything out of place. Her eyes always bring me comfort. They are both beautiful and always on the lookout. Cargo greeted Sage, sitting in her path to me. Cargo's tail was wagging, and he looked up to demand some attention. Sage greeted Cargo with a, "Hi, buddy," and pet him while stepping around to get closer to me at the railing. "So apparently everything went okay?" Sage began. "Manuel was very happy. He said the trip back was the quickest ever. What did you do, take a shortcut?" No, he just lost track of time, I said evasively. Well, you have a happy customer, Sage added, as she handed me an envelope with cash in it. Thanks. Do I get a couple days off? I asked. I thought you enjoyed flying, Sage said with a mocking sarcasm. I do enjoy flying. I also enjoy fishing and beer, just trying to reschedule my life. I decided not to join in the sarcasm banter. Returning to a serious tone, Sage explained, we have no missions scheduled right now, so I should be able to plan for a few days off. So it is okay if I head out of town for a weekend. Sure. Take some time off, Sage said, with a nod of her head. We both turned to gaze out over the intercoastal waterway. We leaned on the railing and watched the boat traffic. A sailboat eased by, its wood trim gleaming in the sun. We could hear the sailboat's engine make a putt-putt sound. Cargo leaned against Sage, seemingly trying to push us closer together. This part of our visits always feels a bit awkward to me. Sage and I are friends, but we are not lovers. It feels, however, like more than simply an arrangement between business partners. It should be simple, but it is too complicated to discuss. After a few minutes, Sage asked, what are you going to do with your time off? I'm not sure, I said, pausing. Maybe I'll take a fishing charter out of the Keys. The truth was, I would just hang around Hollywood with cargo. It just seemed too pathetic to ask for time off with no plans. After a few more minutes of awkward silence, Sage said, goodbye. Take care of yourself, Brody. I will be in touch. She then turned and walked away without ever looking back. She never did look back. It gave me an opportunity to study the rhythm of her walk. Her ponytail swung back and forth as I watched her walk to the car. While there was still some daylight, I took cargo down to Duke's. It was just south of Hollywood, a mile or two down Ocean Drive. Duke's was a rundown shack with a corrugated tin roof on the beach. There were only four tables inside. The bar had a dozen stools. Duke really didn't put much effort into decorating. It still had a war poster featuring a girl flexing her bicep. The bold letters along the top of the poster read, "We can do it." There was no menu. Duke's serves burgers with fries or fish and chips. They had Ballantine ale and a couple of other beers, but no hard liquor. I liked Duke's. I didn't have to dress up to go there. For the most part, people left me alone. And best of all, they let Cargo hang out on the patio facing the ocean. Cargo liked their burgers. He didn't care much for their fish and chips. We arrived at Duke's as the sun was just above the horizon. Cargo took up his usual place on the patio looking out on the ocean. I went inside, ordered a burger for Cargo, fish and chips for myself, and a Ballantine ale. It was a Thursday night, so there were only a handful of others in the place. They were all out on the patio. Maria was working as both bartender and waitress. Maria was barely over 5 feet tall. She had shoulder-length, wavy black hair and big brown eyes. Her eyes were framed with long, dark lashes. She spoke with an enchanting Spanish accent. As usual, she was wearing a blouse with a low-cut V-neck, showing just the right amount of cleavage. Enough cleavage to help her get tips from male customers, but not so much that she would offend the ladies. Maria was always in motion. She was full of energy. She also would not put up with any bad behavior. She would not hesitate to throw you out of the place, and no one ever put a hand on her. Taking on Maria not only wasn't easy, but it meant taking on every regular in the place. Though fights were few and far between, the regulars at Duke's were no stranger to the art form. As I waited for my food, I watched Maria as she went out to the patio and back in. Food and drink went out, empty dishes returned. She moved smoothly and quickly. Her walk gave the impression of floating just above the floor. The burger arrived, and Maria took it out to Cargo with a big bowl of water. I stayed inside. I figured Cargo would appreciate a bit of attention from Maria, just like the other regulars. I could see his tail wag from my stool at the bar. Cargo was happy. My fish and chips were done just as there was a bit of a lull for Maria. She brought it to me and leaned onto the bar. I tried to be a gentleman and keep my gaze up.
Hey there, loner. How are you?
Doing fine.
Where you been? I missed you,
she said, as she flashed an engaging smile. Another fishing trip.
Catch anything?
They did. I don't get to fish, I just fly.
So when do you get to go fishing?
When are you going to go fishing with me, Maria? Maria laughed and eased her way back up to standing. Diplomatically, she said,
you know I can't leave this place for long.
Then she was off to wait on another customer. Maria and I flirted all the time, though she flirted with all of her customers. I felt an attraction to Maria, but was never sure if it was mutual. There were times I felt like we were closer than just server and customer, but every time I asked her out, she would be evasive. Perhaps it was best, I figured. This way I could always drop by Duke's and see a friendly face. Relationships are never so dependable. Well, not relationships with people, anyway. After I'd finished my fish and chips, Maria brought me another Ballantine ale, and I took it out to the patio. I took a seat next to Cargo, and we looked out on the ocean at night. Many stars were out. There was a waxing gibbous moon. It would be a full moon in a few days. There was enough light from the moon on this clear night to see couples walking along the shoreline. Cargo moved closer to me so I could pet him. We watched the ocean together, and I lost track of time as I enjoyed my beer. It was well after midnight when Maria took the seat next to me, beer in hand. I looked around and saw that we were the only ones in the place. The cook had gone home. I could smell her perfume. Windsong. Why I recognized the perfume is a very long story for another time. Maria and I made small talk, sipped our beers, and enjoyed each other's company. It was moments like this that made me think I was more to her than just another customer. She would occasionally touch me on the arm as we talked, then pull away again. Each time she touched me, I felt like electricity flowed from her hand to my arm. It was also why Duke's was my favorite hangout, though it was a difficult thing to explain to anyone else. We finished our beers and I waited for her to lock up. She gave me a close hug and stood on her tiptoes to give me a quick peck on the cheek. Then she flashed her brilliant smile and got into her 1950 Nash Rambler convertible. The car was red with a white top and interior. It seemed like a good match to her fiery personality. She had left the top down all day and drove off with her hair flowing in the warm night air. Her brief hug still left me feeling warm all over. I had a smile on my face as Cargo and I got into the truck and headed back west to the apartment. Finally, things were going rather smoothly. The missions Sage brought me were routine enough. Life was good. There was no reason to make any drastic changes. The apartment had finally cooled when we arrived in the wee hours of the morning. I sat at the small dining room table and counted the money. It was an even $1,000. Not bad. I had used 650 gallons of fuel, well under the conservative 100 gallons per hour used for flight plans, because I was flying unloaded and took it real easy whenever I could. So $170 would go to fuel, and $20 or $30 would go towards oil. Jake would get $50 or so to make sure everything was tip-top for the next flight. That would leave me with $750 to live on for a while. It could be a week or more before my next payday. It could be a month. My rent and utilities were less than $75 a month, so I was in no hurry for the next mission. I pulled $400 out of the stack and folded the remainder up tightly. I unscrewed the face from the switch in the kitchen, stuffed the bills in, and replaced the switch face. Finally, I was ready to turn in. I didn't plan to get up early. I closed the patio door all the way, leaving just an inch for some fresh air. The lock rod I dropped in the track had been shortened for a perfect fit like this, leaving the door just a bit open for air. I closed the window in the combination living-dining room. I left the window in my bedroom open just 4 inches or so no one could possibly fit through. I inserted the stick that prevents this window from opening any wider. I planned on sleeping soundly, so I did not want to worry. Cargo curled up on the floor at the foot of the bed, his head on his paws. He always went to sleep with his eyes pointed toward the door of the room, always the faithful watchdog. I felt the fatigue of the last 3 days as I took off my shirt and trousers. I was tempted to sleep in my clothes, but I knew I would be asleep a long time. I wanted to be as comfortable as possible. Pulling my 1911 from the gear bag, I placed it on the nightstand next to the bed. The bed felt like a cool embrace as I eased into it. The tension from the mission finally eased from my body. The aches and pains were not too bad, just enough to know I had been productive. I looked forward to waking up refreshed. End of chapter 3. Chapter 4. I dreamt I was back in China. There were air raid bells ringing. Wait, air raid alerts are sirens. Slowly the fog lifted. I realized the bell was my telephone. I took a couple of breaths and sat up. The phone continued to ring. If this was a telemarketer, I was going to give him a piece of my mind. Yeah, I said impatiently. Lover, I heard on the other end of the line. I miss you so much. I stood for a moment looking at Cargo. The quizzical look on his face summed up the situation perfectly. Slowly I realized Sage had just asked to meet. See you soon, I replied. Then I hung up the phone. I looked back at the clock. It was 8:30 in the morning. Outside, a steady rain was falling. Skipping a shower, I dressed and grabbed my fedora. I usually didn't carry when I met Sage, but I stared at the 1911 for a while. A voice in my head told me it was better to be prepared. Something was not right. I decided to stash the pistol in my truck just in case. Cargo dashed through the rain into the truck. I followed behind, moving just a bit more slowly. It was still hot. The rain made it muggy. I rolled the windows of the truck down despite the rain. Cargo and I would be wet, but cool. We headed east on Pines Boulevard. A few minutes from home, the rain eased to a light drizzle. Before we reached the intercoastal, the rain had stopped completely. Daylight was getting a firm hold on the morning as we pulled into the parking spot near Sage's big new green Cadillac Fleetwood. Sage was waiting for us at the railing. She was wearing the same hat, but wore a dark blue blouse with black capri pants. She was not trying to hide her spectacular figure. Cargo ran ahead to greet her, still wet from the truck ride. He shook himself off right next to Sage. I smiled. It was as if he had read my mind. I worked hard to suppress a smile as I walked up next to Sage. "What's up?" I asked.
"We have an opportunity, Brody. Manuel has made an investment in some shipwreck coins. They have been salvaged by divers, but they are afraid to come ashore. They fear the treasure will be confiscated by the Cuban government if they go near the island. They're currently at sea, disguised as a fishing boat. They need to offload their treasure quickly."
Sage spoke quickly. Her eyes stayed fixed on me to gauge my reaction. "How did they get paid?" I asked. I sensed she was going to ask me to do the exchange. I hate exchanges.
"The exchange will need to be at sea, as the goods are delivered. I know you don't like exchanges, Brody, but we have a $1 million opportunity within our grasp."
"When?"
"Today or tomorrow."
"Tonight or tomorrow," I corrected.
"Day or night. It needs to happen within 48 hours,
Sage replied. Her gaze still remained on my eyes.
"We can do this,"
she added. I took a couple of deep breaths. I did not like the smell of the deal. It was too rushed. It was too good. It smelled like a grift. "How do you know the coins exist?" I queried.
"Manuel knows the salvage crew well. They've been looking for the shipwreck for several years. Manuel is confident that they have what they say they have."
"Can we land at Vila Acuña?" I asked.
"We will not have any help from our government contracts for this mission. They have heard word that treasure has been found. They're going to be on high alert for any vessels that may be carrying salvage cargo. Manuel does not think the boat can come that close to Cuban land,"
Sage explained. "So we're looking at a boat transfer," I speculated.
"It looks that way."
"I don't like it. If they can't get the treasure out by boat, what makes them think we can?"
"Well, Brody, it seems that you have something of a reputation for finding a way to get the job done. Any chance that you could stash a plane somewhere and shuttle the cargo to it after the exchange?"
"I just don't know. Is Manuel planning on riding along?"
"I would expect so. He would want to keep an eye on his $300,000 investment to make sure he gets his $1 million treasure."
"He is paying in U.S. dollars?" I asked.
"No, Cuban currency, but worth $300,000 in U.S. dollars.
So he has an opportunity to triple his money. That does sound too good to pass up. Too good to be true. I was thinking out loud now. Sage gently took my hand.
"I need your help,"
she pleaded. I knew if I didn't help her, she was going to do this anyway, and I didn't like the deal. I had to figure out an angle. "Do you know of a boat with a captain that you can trust?" I asked Sage.
"Yes, I know of a captain. I trust him thoroughly. Tito has done work for me before, but he can only work from Dominican ports. He could not put in at Cuba or the U.S.
"Tito? Like Tito Puente?"
"Yeah, spelled the same."
"See if Tito is available. Then meet me at noon for lunch. My apartment. Tell Manuel that I won't take the job, but that you have someone I recommend that will be perfect for it."
"So you're not taking the job?"
Sage asked, concerned. "I didn't say that. I said to tell Manuel that I was not taking the job." A smile crept across my face as a plan started to come together. If Sage could not figure it out, then it just might work.
"Okay. See you then,"
Sage said. She turned and covered the short distance to her Cadillac in 7 swings of her ponytail. I took some time to think. Cargo looked up at me. "What do you think, buddy?" I asked him. He just kept looking up at me. Cargo and I got back in my truck, and we headed west, back to the apartment. The sun was at our back, making the drive back a little easier on the eyes. Driving helps me think. The drive back gave me a chance to put a plan together. When Sage arrived, I had a chart of the Caribbean spread out on my small dining room table. "Did you get in touch with Manuel and your captain?" I asked.
"Yes, I did. They're waiting for me to get back to them with details."
"Great. Let me tell you the plan so far." I then laid out what I'd figured so far. An island group, 650 miles from our location in Florida, and 200 miles east-northeast of Cuba, had a couple of very small islands. Salt Key had a few dozen inhabitants, but 3 miles northeast of Salt Key is Cotton Key. Cotton Key had a long beach along its southeastern shore.
The water is too shallow to bring a boat all the way to the beach. So here's what we'll do, I explained. They load the coins into their dinghy and row it ashore. The coins need to be in sacks or buckets weighing 40 pounds or less, so one person can lift them. Then they return to their fishing boat. It will be anchored a mile offshore, directly east of the island. You, Tito, and Manuel anchor 1 mile directly south of the beach, more than a mile from the salvage crew. You row from Tito's boat to the island in a dinghy to verify the coins are there. If they are, you signal Manuel, and Tito takes his boat over to pay the salvage crew. I explained the safeguards that were in place with this arrangement. If the coins were not there, Manuel would be able to quickly make his way to Salt Key for refuge. If the coins were there, and the money was paid, the salvage crew could just kill Manuel and the captain. However, they would still have to row their dinghy to the island to retrieve the coins. With 100 rounds and a couple of 1911s, you could put up a heck of a fight. It wouldn't be a clean heist. There were also safeguards for the salvage crew. If you left the island with the coins before payment, the salvage crew could easily intercept before you could make it back to Tito's boat. If they are to be trusted, as much as Manuel says, then all will go well. After payment is made, the salvage crew will head off to the north, and you'll row back to Manuel's boat. Manuel's boat will then go to an undisclosed location to get the cargo on its way. What do you think? I asked.
It sounds risky for me, Sage replied. It sounds like I am likely to be left stranded on an island in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean.
I agree. The question is, does the lure of a $1 million payoff make it seem plausible?
What are you driving at?
She asked. The whole thing feels like a grift. It's too good. It's too quick. Too rushed. There is no way to do the deal without being exposed, I explained. Once they have the money, there are too many ways for them to recover the coins.
So we bow out?
Sage said, concerned again. I was thinking we run a grift of our own. If they are on the up and up, it won't matter. But if they are planning on double-crossing Manuel, we may just be able to surprise them. Manuel won't know the real plan, so he won't be able to tip them off.
How do we run a grift?
Sage asked. Can you see it? If not, maybe they won't either, I said.
Counterfeit money?
No. If they are on the up and up, we keep our end of the bargain. I have flown over Cotton Key. The beach looks to be over 2,000 feet long with a gentle curve. Flying empty, I should be able to get Pegasus in there. She has extra cabin wing tanks installed. If I fill them, as well as the wing tanks, I can make the 1,300-mile round trip and stay on station for a few hours until you signal me. You can signal me with a portable ham radio. Manuel would think it's only for him, but when I hear that the coins are real, I will start for the island. As Manuel makes the payment, I will land on the island. You jump on board with the coins and we take off headed back to Florida.
What about Manuel?
If the salvage crew is trustworthy, there are no issues. If they cannot be trusted, Manuel's best chance is if he no longer has the coins.
Are you sure you can land on the beach?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, but we have to do it during daylight. Cotton Key is about 100 miles from the Dominican Republic. That would take a fishing boat 10 to 12 hours to cover. I started to add up all the time required for the operation. A commercial flight to the Dominican Republic, travel to the fishing boat, then travel to Cotton Key. It would take 15 to 20 hours, and we did not yet have all the players on board. So, I said, thinking out loud, we need agreements today. You and Manuel need to fly to the Dominican Republic tomorrow. The fishing boat must leave by 0200 hours. The rendezvous will be set for 1600 hours. That allows a couple of hours for delays.
Why me? Sage asked. Wouldn't it make more sense to hire somebody that would be a better gunfighter?
I need someone I can trust totally. You and I must be the only ones that know I am part of the plan. I like Manuel, but I do not trust him. I definitely do not trust his friends. I then added, how do we securely contact the salvage crew? Sage explained that Manuel was able to contact them through a marine radio, then switch to a ham radio frequency that was secure. This all seemed too convenient to me. I was more convinced than ever it was a grift. I just hoped there were actually silver coins that had been salvaged. It didn't make much sense for the salvage crew to agree to this exchange process if the coins didn't exist. Here's the bottom line as I see it, I said, summing up the plan. You make it to the island, and I pick you up there. If the coins are there, then we get them. If not, then I leave with just you. Manuel is on his own.
All right. I'm in, Sage said.
I gave Sage the latitude and longitude of Cotton Key. We reviewed the schedule and procedure. The salvage crew was to remain docked a mile offshore, or we would go. Our boat would stay a mile and a half from the salvage boat until Sage was able to row ashore and verify the coins were real. I tuned in the weather broadcast. The forecast called for winds under 10 miles an hour for the next 2 days. This just might work, I thought. We agreed to meet again at 8 o'clock to confirm the mission was a go. Once Manuel and Sage left for the Dominican Republic, we would only be able to communicate through a portable ham radio Sage would pack into her luggage. Sage left to sell the plan to Manuel. Cargo and I went back to the airport. While Cargo went to sleep under a wing, I found Jake and asked him to make sure Pegasus was ready to go by the next morning. Jake was only 5.5 feet tall, but he was built like a stone. A former Marine, he still wore his dark hair in Marine Corps style. He could lift more than I could, and he never seemed to tire. He always did what he promised, and was a gifted mechanic. He was one of the few people I trusted. I requested a full load of fuel, including 400 extra gallons in the cabin tanks. The total fuel load would be 1,200 gallons. This should be enough for me to fly to Cotton Key, remain on station for 4 hours, and return home with a little fuel left to spare. I could carry even more fuel, but I needed to land on Cotton Key as light as possible. I considered pulling the scout off the plane. I wasn't likely to need a motorcycle, and I could lighten the load a bit if I left it in the hangar. However, if I needed anything after landing at my farmer's field, I would need transportation. I stared at the bike for a while and decided to leave it in place. I looked up the frequencies of radio direction finder transmitters located in the Dominican Republic and recorded them on a notepad I taped on the side of the cockpit. The frequencies of AM radio stations were also noted. Any AM radio station can be used to determine position if you know where the transmitter tower is located. I can find Cuba by dead reckoning, but finding the tiny Cotton Key was a bit trickier. To make the navigation a bit more challenging, I wanted to fly low and away from Cotton Key until I was needed. I wanted to stay out of sight, or at least far enough off that I would not be noticed. If I was 10 miles from the key, I could be there in 6 minutes. 20 miles would be way too far. I would be relying on the radio direction finder to pinpoint my position on this mission. I made sure clean mop heads were stowed in the back with a couple of handles. I would use these to cover up my tail number and restore it after the mission. We could not rely on Sage's network looking the other way, so I didn't want to be identified on this mission. The paint I used cleaned off easily with a bucket of alcohol, but resisted weather for several days. If anyone did spot me over the ocean, all they would see is a green C-47. Most would likely assume it was a military flight. As long as I wasn't spotted by the U.S. military, that worked in my favor. I also stashed a couple of quart bottles up in my seat to pee into. I would be in the air for more than 12 hours, and I would not have a co-pilot to take over the controls for me. As long as the weather was calm, I could trim Pegasus out to fly on her own for a few minutes. I did not like going far from the controls, though. I paid Jake and thanked him for all of his work. Then Cargo and I headed to the grocery store. We needed a day's worth of food and water. I apologized to Cargo for the dry dog food he was going to have to eat on this mission. With preparations underway, I returned to my apartment around 3 o'clock. I was surprised to see the familiar big green Cadillac Fleetwood parked outside my apartment already. Sage was sitting on the stone bench of my patio. Her face looked like a stone carving of determination. "Everything all right?" I asked.
"Yes and no. Manuel is on board. Tito is available. But there is one issue and one demand."
"Demand?" I asked, with my eyebrows failing to hide some concern.
"Yeah, they want the exchange to occur at night. It's a deal breaker. You can't land on the island at night."
I sat down next to Sage to ponder this. Cargo was still nudging Sage, looking for attention. Finally, she noticed and started to pet him. "Maybe I could land on the island at night. It would be difficult, but I do have a full moon. The weather report says clear skies. If weather kept me from landing, then you could finish the deal as Manuel knows it. No one needs to know I plan to land."
"Maybe it's not worth it,"
Sage sighed. "What's our cut?"
$100,000.
"Ask Manuel for $200,000, I said calmly. "He would still be more than doubling his money. Smugglers balance risk and reward. It's what they do. Greater risk means greater reward. The challenge is to keep the two in perspective. The fact that we both sat and pondered if $200,000 was enough to take the risk made us both realize it was not worth it for $100,000. The question that remained was if the risk was worth $200,000. After a few minutes of contemplation, Sage placed both hands on my arm, looked directly into my eyes, and said, with a steady gaze,
"Let's do this."
I looked into her eyes for a while, and then I agreed. I would risk my life for her. I would for many reasons. It should have been me, not Eric that took that fatal round. She's the person that I trust most in this world. She's the reason I'm living a comfortable life after the war. Not to mention that I share the male weakness of not being able to say no to a stunning lady that takes you by the arm and stares into your eyes. What worried me more was the risk to her life. I didn't want her life on my conscience, but her gaze lifted that burden from me. Sage knew the risks. She took responsibility for them. She didn't need me to protect her. She needed me to be her partner. Okay, let's do this. What's the issue? I said.
Manuel and I can take a flight to the Dominican Republic. The problem is that Manuel doesn't think he can get 300,000 in Cuban currency through customs. Manuel wants you to fly us and the money to the island.
I was unlikely to be any more successful getting a big stack of currency through customs if I landed in a major airport. I didn't know of any fields in the Dominican Republic to put in at either, without being spotted or having to pull off a spectacular and risky landing. I figured one high-risk landing per mission was all we should plan on. Does Manuel trust you? I asked.
Yes.
If you two get yourselves down to Tito's boat and out to sea, I'll drop the money to you by air. If we do the drop late in the evening, there would still be some daylight. I will then fly off and wait for the night exchange. Money drop at 1900, exchange at midnight. I'll have twilight arriving just after 0600 in the morning, so I can land back here with some daylight. If I carry full fuel, I can stay up for 17 hours, 18 if I baby it. I stared up as I created the plan while I told Sage. Then I looked at Sage and I said, I will need that money tonight. Sage took off in her caddy to contact Manuel. I took the time to feed cargo and grab myself a bite to eat. I called Jake and told him to fill all the tanks, all 800 gallons in the wing tanks and 800 gallons in the cabin tanks. I told him it was a cross-country fishing expedition. He didn't believe me, but that's all right. I was pretty sure Jake had a good idea what I really did for a living, but he never asked and he never pried. Then Cargo and I lay down and took a well-deserved nap. End of chapter 4. Chapter 5. Someone knocking on the door woke me up. I grabbed my 1911 and walked to the door, looking through the peephole. I could clearly make out Sage. I opened the door and let her in.
Did I wake you?
Yep, I said as I slowly made my way over to the dining room table and put my pistol down. Just getting a nap. Sage was dressed in black capri pants again and a form-fitting light sweater. She was not wearing a hat. Her hair was down. She was ready for business. Her perfume filled my tiny apartment, but I couldn't identify the scent.
Manuel is gathering the money. He requested that we both meet him in Miami to pick it up.
You driving?
Sure.
When?
We can leave right away.
Okay. Let me put on some clean clothes. I put on a clean shirt and a fresh pair of khakis. I grabbed my fedora and my 1911. Then I grabbed a couple of extra items and threw them in my bag. Sorry, Cargo. You have to sit this one out, I told him. He looked terribly disappointed, but a big city was really not Cargo's best turf. Sage's Cadillac had a smooth ride. It was also quieter than my truck. It gave us a chance to review the timing of the plan in great detail. I told her to place 6 May West flotation vests in the bow of the boat, 3 on each side. I would look for this feature to be certain I had the right boat. I gave Sage a signaling mirror to use if the sun was shining. I also gave her a signaling flashlight. We both knew Morse code. I told her to signal L-O-V-E if all was well, H-A-T-E if things had come undone and I must turn back. Either signal would confirm I had the right fishing boat in sight. If the coins were real, I told her to signal H-E-A-D, and if the coins were not real, the signal would be T-A-I-L. I told her to row to the downwind end of the beach. If the winds were negligible or a crosswind, then row to the southern end of the beach. I would start for the beach when she signaled head or tail. When she heard me approaching, I told her to shine the flashlight across the beach, onto the trees, and then down to her feet and back. I hoped the moonlight would be enough, but any little extra that helped me determine where the runway began was worth a try. I figured the moving flashlight would help me find the beginning of the beach. My plan was to set down near the dinghy. Once Pegasus came to a stop, I would turn her around and taxi back to the dinghy, set the brakes, but keep the engine running. I'd open the cargo door. She'd toss in the coins and then climb in herself. I'd then spin the plane around and take off. At least, that was the plan. We double-checked frequencies. Every hour on the hour, we were both to monitor for any change in status. For this mission, I planned to monitor the ham radio off and between the top of the hour. The drive not only gave us an opportunity to review the mission, but to become more comfortable with each other's company. I felt no awkwardness, though we'd spent more time together this day than any since Eric's death. Having run out of details to review, I was able to enjoy the sunset over my right shoulder. The heat of the day was fading some, and it was a great evening for an automobile trip. I spent some time trying to identify her perfume. We met Manuel at his girlfriend's house. It was a rental on the outskirts of Miami. He had sent her off, shopping, I think. It was only Manuel, Sage, and I in the living room of the tiny bungalow.
Señor Malone, tell me why I should trust you with my life savings.
Manuel's voice had none of the jovial tone I had come to know. He was all business. I will not leave Sage stranded, I said.
Ah, I see you two are lovers.
No, we... Then Sage cut in.
What Brody and I have between us is deeper than romance, Manuel. I trust my life to him, without hesitation.
As she spoke, she placed both hands on my arm. Her voice was low and sultry, but steady and serious.
Pulling back a bit, Manuel said, I see.
Not a word was spoken for what seemed like an hour, but it was likely just a minute or two.
All right. The money goes with you, Señor Malone. But the lady stays with me. We travel together from here on.
I didn't like the implication of his demand, but turned to look at Sage to see how she felt about it. Sage nodded approval. She said,
I'll be okay. You take the car back. See you in a few days.
Then Sage caught me completely off guard. She reached up, took my head in both hands, and pulled me toward her. She kissed me on the lips, and then said,
I'll be fine.
It was hard to return my focus to the mission. I smelled her perfume. A million questions ran through my mind, but we couldn't discuss them there. Perhaps that's why Sage chose that moment to kiss me? I would have to sort those questions out later. I took the keys from Sage, and Manuel set the money on the table. I then reviewed the essential elements of the plan. They needed to depart the Dominican Republic no later than noon, on a heading of due north. An earlier departure would be preferred. I would intercept their course at 1900 hours, or 7 o'clock in the evening. The cash would be wrapped in orange life rings. I would try to drop the package north of them, so they would be able to continue toward the objective as they picked it up.
How are we going to get the coins into the U.S., Señor Malone?
Manuel asked. I told him to travel east after the exchange. This would take them out to open water. I then showed him how to construct a snatch from fishing rods and attach it to the coins. I drew a diagram out. I told him I would return to the U.S. to refuel and fly back at first light with a hook to catch the payload. Pegasus would grab the coins with the hook, and I would return to my farmer's field back in Florida. When they returned, the coins would be waiting for him. I lied. I cast my gaze back toward Sage. I didn't want to get drilled too much on such a bold-faced lie. I stood up and shook Manuel's hand. Take good care of her, I said deliberately.
Si, Señor Malone.
I took the money out to the car and put it in my bag. I took the 1911 I had kept tucked in my waistband during the meeting and slipped it into the bag as well. Then I tossed the bag and its contents into the trunk of the Cadillac. The trunk was huge. The bag looked rather lonely in there. I closed the trunk lid and headed back to my apartment. My mind was racing as I drove back. Why did she kiss me? Had she clouded my judgment? How did Sage really feel about me? Should I have walked away from this deal? It was too late to walk away from the deal now. I had a pile of foreign currency in my trunk. I needed to deliver it to a fishing boat in the middle of the Atlantic less than 48 hours from now, or Sage was in grave danger. I had to focus, but I found it difficult as my thoughts kept returning to Sage. Had she felt in danger? Did she think she may not return? Had that liberated her to be able to show her true feelings? Or did it bring out emotions that were not real? For whatever reason, I'd seen a side of Sage that I'd never seen before. I wanted to finish the mission, not just to get paid, but to find out the answers to those questions. Did she think money was not enough motivation for me? I wanted to settle down to a good meal. I wanted to go to Duke's and clear my head, but I couldn't pull up in this caddy without raising suspicion. I settled for an evening with Cargo at my apartment. When I came through the front door, Cargo greeted me enthusiastically. That helped me calm down a bit. After setting my 1911 on the nightstand, I stashed the cash in the ceiling tiles above my closet. I then closed all the windows and locked them. The temperature was a bit warm, but it was tolerable. I needed to try and get rid of the tension and concentrate if I was going to pull this off. With all my windows locked, no one would be able to sneak into my apartment. During my time in China, I learned breath meditation. The idea of breath meditation is that you focus on your breath and empty your mind of all other thoughts. That seemed like a good idea. My mind was a jumble of thoughts. I needed to clear it. I turned out all the lights. Some moonlight filtered in through the windows. I grabbed a Ballantine from the fridge and sat on the floor next to my bedroom door. I leaned up against the wall. Cargo curled up next to me. I focused on my breath and began to meditate. with a beer, or two. End of chapter 5. Chapter 6. The alarm woke me at 8 o'clock. After breakfast, I loaded cargo into the truck and headed east once again. It was another clear morning, with a bright sun making it hard to see through the windshield. We headed to a marine supply store in Hallandale near the coast. I bought 5 orange life rings and 2 buckets that just fit inside the life rings. I also bought 50 feet of braided line. I brought the supplies back to the apartment. I retrieved the bundled currency from its hiding place and stuffed it into the buckets. The money just barely fit inside the 2 buckets. Cloth tape was used to seal the buckets together, creating a weathertight package. I added additional tape around the bottoms of the buckets to ensure that they could not separate. With the braided line, I tied the 5 life rings together and slipped the 2 buckets inside. With more line, I tied the whole assembly into a bundle that I was satisfied would not come undone. I made up some peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. I put each one in a bag to make it an easy snack while flying. The life ring bundle was loaded into the truck. I also loaded the sandwiches, a tin of pretzels, water, and food for cargo. I tossed a jacket and an extra pair of sunglasses into my flight bag. I grabbed the 1911 and 6 extra magazines, tossing them into the bag. The magazines were all loaded, 7 rounds per mag. That made a total of 49 rounds, plus 1 in the chamber. If I needed more than 50 rounds, it was going to be a bad day. Heck, if I needed 1 round, it was going to be a bad day. I loaded cargo up, and we took the truck to the airport. I unlocked the hangar and pulled the truck in next to Pegasus. A quick scan showed no unusual activity at the airport as I closed the doors again. In the back of the hangar were a couple of cargo parachutes. The cargo chutes were far too large for this small package. However, each cargo chute has a smaller drogue chute that deploys before the main chute. The drogue chute would help to slow the package down when I drop it. I attached the small drogue chute to the life ring bundle and went to the tail of Pegasus. Pegasus still had the glider tow hook installed. I made a loop of line that would keep the drogue chute tightly folded while it held the bundle in place at the tail of the aircraft. Inside the closed hangar, I hooked the bundle to the glider tow hook and released it a few times. When I was satisfied it would work, I stashed the bundle inside of Pegasus. I packed the food and water in the cockpit behind the co-pilot's seat on the right. I added a couple of blankets to the space behind the pilot's seat. The blankets would provide some padding for cargo if the ride got a bit rough. I double-checked all the aircraft preparations. Every fuel tank was full. 800 gallons in the wings. Another 800 gallons in the cabin tanks. Both engines were absolutely topped off with oil. The electrical systems all checked out. 5 metal cans were secured in back. 1 5-gallon can of olive drab paint. 1 5-gallon can of alcohol. The other 3 actually had oil in them. When I had finished all the checks, I sat down next to cargo and leaned up against a tire. It was noon. I still had a couple of hours before I planned to take off and fly Pegasus over to the farmer's field. The field was only a few minutes away from my plane, but was a long ride from any stores. I wanted to take a few minutes and make sure that I hadn't forgotten anything. By 2 o'clock, it would have been more than 12 hours since I'd finished my ale, and it would be 36 hours before I would climb up to any significant altitude. If you're flying solo in a DC-3 and you take a nap, it does not end well. The lull let my mind wander. I began to think of Sage again. I wondered where she was at that moment. Their flights to the Dominican Republic were scheduled for that afternoon. I wondered what she was thinking. I wondered if she was thinking of me. If she was thinking of me, I wondered if she would be able to concentrate on the job at hand with me in her thoughts. I knew it would be difficult for me to focus on the job at hand. Perhaps we should have hired a gunfighter to row the dinghy ashore. I had to push these thoughts back out of my mind. I had to concentrate on the job at hand. If I overlooked anything, there was unlikely to be a second chance. Cargo lifted his head and wagged his tail slightly. A smile came across my face. Ready for an adventure, Cargo? His tail wagged faster. Focus on the moment, I thought. Right now, focus on cargo. In a couple of hours, I would be flying. I awoke from my impromptu nap around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Satisfied that Pegasus was fully prepared, I removed the pins from her landing gear. Quietly, I slid open the back hangar doors and prepared to taxi her out of the hangar. With cargo in his place behind the pilot seat, I did my last systems check. The right engine cranked over and came to life as I hit the mags. The left engine cranked over and came to life when I flipped the left mag switch. I watched the temperature gauges and let the engines warm up easily. I was going to need these engines. No need to stress them now. After taxiing out and setting the brake, I went back and closed the hangar doors, leaving my truck inside. I snapped the lock on the hangar doors. Returning to the cockpit, I contacted the tower and requested clearance for takeoff. Niner 6937, clear for takeoff. Runway 28L, came the reply. Runway 28L was one of the east-west runways. A heading of 280 would face me west, directly into the light breeze. With both cockpit windows open, I took off into the hot Florida afternoon sky. Pegasus was heavy. She was full of fuel. I set the engines to 47 inches of mercury, not quite all that I could ask of them. I used more runway than usual, nearly 3,000 feet, and slowly eased her into the air. The short run to my farmer's field was not long enough to bother pulling up the landing gear. It took a little extra care to gently put Pegasus down in the field. I rarely carried heavy cargo, and the extra fuel for this trip added more than 5,000 pounds. Once safely down, I taxied to the southwest corner of the field and spun Pegasus around. As the sun continued to set, her tail would be partially cloaked in the shadow of the trees. At 4 o'clock, I turned on the ham radio and listened. No word yet. No surprise. It would likely be a few hours before Manuel and Sage reached the fishing boat. First things first, I transferred some oil into a 1-gallon bucket. Then I unpacked the ladder and climbed up on the wing to top off the engines. They had only used a quart in the short flight, but I would need every drop of oil they could carry to stay aloft for 16 or 17 hours. I put the locking pins into the landing gear and tied a red ribbon on my control yoke to make sure I did not forget to remove them. This was not the night to let the hydraulics bleed down and leave the bird sitting with a wing in the dirt. It was time for a mental break. Cargo wanted to play, and I obliged him. How wonderful it must be to gain endless joy from a simple stick. With the last hour of sunlight, I retrieved the olive drab paint stored in the tail. Grabbing a clean mop head, I painted over the N6937, boldly painted on each side of the tail. The paint would be fully dry by morning. As night fell, cargo and I retreated into Pegasus. I often napped in the co-pilot seat. However, with the knowledge that I would spend more than half a day sitting in that seat, I grabbed a couple of blankets and set them out on the carpeting on the cargo floor. The bed was on an incline, but at least it was a flat incline. Using my jacket as a pillow, I tried to get some valuable sleep. The sun beating on the fuselage quickly warmed it and woke me up. As I began to rise, cargo raised his head. He was sleeping in his usual spot behind the pilot seat. I laughed as I realized how much more comfortable he had been. At 10 o'clock, I checked the ham radio. Silence. Manuel and Sage must be at the fishing boat by now, I thought. I hoped they were underway. Cargo and I scrambled out of the plane and had breakfast. Cargo ate his dry dog food without any complaint. The sun was hot. We sat in the shade and tried to stay cool. Cargo was panting. I opted not to exercise him. We sat in the shade and waited. At 11 o'clock and noon, I checked the ham radio. Still silence. Tension rose in my chest. I took deep breaths. I felt my heart beating. It was time for the last preparation and takeoff. I retrieved the life ring bundle with the Cuban currency from the cargo area. I secured it to the tail hook and double-checked that it would release. I then secured it again and taped the lever in the cockpit to ensure it did not release prematurely. If I accidentally deployed the package at a random location in the Atlantic Ocean, it would never be found again, and Sage would be in grave danger. By 1 o'clock, Pegasus was ready for takeoff. Cargo was laying in his bed panting. The cargo door was closed and secured. I had my co-pilot's window open, but the hot breeze it let in did little to cool us off. A last check of the ham radio was still silent. It was time to begin the mission. This is actually the time in a mission when my anxiety is highest. Once the mission is underway, I typically relax a bit. Or at least, I'm distracted by the job at hand. I brought both engines to life and taxied over to the east end of the field. There was a light westerly breeze, and I could use the help of a headwind to get Pegasus in the air with a full load of fuel. I advanced the engines to full takeoff power, 52 inches of mercury on the manifold pressure gauges. This level of power was not to be maintained for more than 5 minutes. Pegasus rumbled across the field. The tail came up, and the rumbling stopped. I gently climbed out, pulling up the landing gear and settling in for a long flight. I wanted to avoid flying over the Florida Keys. There was an Army Air Force base there, and a daylight run with no tail numbers might attract some attention. So I crossed the Everglades on a southwest course at 800 feet. The breeze through my one open window was refreshing. I put my elbow on the windowsill and tried to relax. Once I was out over open ocean, the cool ocean air felt wonderful. I loved the smell of salt. I needed my sunglasses for these conditions. The eye strain without them was nearly blinding. Flying over the ocean at 800 feet is nearly overwhelming to me. The view seems endless. The horizon is crisp, with no trees to make it ragged. I'm always struck by its beauty. Flying like this for hours can make me numb from overstimulation.
I flew southwest for 45 minutes. Then it turned south for a few minutes. I could just make out Key West through the left window of the cockpit if I dipped my left wing slightly. Once I had cleared Key West, I turned east-southeast. I held a heading of 110 degrees and scanned the horizon for other aircraft. There was a lot of nothing out here, exactly what I had hoped for. It would be 4 more hours before I would be near the fishing boat's location. I settled into a trance-like state. The pulsing rhythm of the engines reverberated throughout the plane. Cargo slept. At 2 o'clock, I closed the window so I could hear the ham radio. There was only silence. I opened the window back up to stay cool. The glare on my windshield improved as the sun, while still high in the sky, began to set behind me. The waves below were running east, close to my heading. It was a strong indication that I had a favorable tailwind. I dropped my airspeed to 135 miles an hour to save fuel, still flying just 800 feet off the water. I tried not to think about Sage. I didn't succeed. My mind wandered back to when her hand touched my arm. It reminded me of the electric feeling when Maria touched me. She was wearing a perfume I still could not place. Life seemed a bit easier when I knew where I stood with both Sage and Maria. Nowhere. Perhaps there were still no serious feelings between Sage and I, but the possibility was making it hard to concentrate. I wanted to flip on the ham radio and start transmitting at 3 o'clock. Morse code was not the right way to discuss this, however, and now was not the right time either. At 3 o'clock, I closed my window, put on the headphones, and listened to the ham radio for any signal from Sage. More silence. Two flashes to my right made my heart race. They couldn't be this far west, I thought. I strained to see the source of the flashes. I could see a small fishing boat, perhaps a mile away. I strained to find a pattern to the flashes. Soon I determined it was just the sun reflecting off a half-opened window. As the boat rocked in the ocean waves, it periodically flashed a reflected ray of sunshine into my cockpit. I took a couple of deep breaths and tried to relax again. My mind began to think of all the things that could go wrong. I could lose an engine. Sage and Manuel could have engine problems. The life ring bundle could fail to release. They could fail to retrieve it. The weather could turn bad. This line of thought was not productive, however. I struggled to clear my head again. At 4 o'clock, I once again closed my window and listened in. Still silence. Negative thoughts flooded my mind. Was Sage okay? Why hadn't she tried to contact me? I resisted the urge to send a message to her. I opened my window again and returned to flying. I had been sitting for 3 hours now, and I was tired of sitting. The air was smooth, so I trimmed Pegasus out for a slight climb and eased out of the seat to stretch. Cargo woke up and greeted me. He stood looking up at me and wagged his tail enthusiastically. His tail was thumping audibly against the cockpit wall. It brought a smile to my face. Cargo did what I could not do alone, take my mind off of Sage, and of all the things that could go wrong with this mission. I offered Cargo a little water, and I ate one of my sandwiches. A couple of pretzels helped replace the salt I was surely losing. I then eased my way back into the seat and took over the controls again. Pegasus had climbed up to 1,200 feet and drifted a bit north to a heading of 80 degrees. I took her back down to 800 feet and returned to my original heading. The sun was on its way toward the horizon behind me. I tried to soak in the emerald beauty of the vast ocean before me. In my opinion, there is no sense doing this job if you aren't going to take some time to enjoy it now and then. At 5 o'clock, I once again listened in to the ham radio. Once again, silence. This time, I was mentally ready for the silence. I did not expect to hear any message at 6 o'clock either. I spent the next hour preparing for the rendezvous. I pumped some fuel from the cabin tanks into the wing tanks to keep them full. It would be foolish to run the wing tanks dry when there was still fuel aboard the aircraft, but it would not be hard to do when the action heated up. I tuned in the radio direction finder for Cuba, and then the Dominican Republic. I was looking for a spot in the ocean 105 degrees from Havana and 0 degrees from the Dominican Republic. This would place me 20 degrees due north of the Dominican Republic. Sage and Manuel should already be somewhere due north of that spot. I tuned in the ham radio at 6 o'clock and heard Morse code dots and dashes. I leaned forward in my seat and mentally decoded the broken tones. V-E-L-O-V-E. I was ecstatic. Sage was okay. The mission was a go. We could still pull this off. I returned a L-O-V-E-R in Morse code and returned to my navigation. I monitored the Dominican Republic radio direction finder. Finally, it showed the transmitting tower to be 80 degrees to my right, nearly directly off my right wing. I banked left and headed due north. It was 6:21 p.m.
1821 in military time. I was ahead of schedule. I scanned the water ahead of me, looking for Sage and Manuel's fishing boat. A boat off to my right looked promising, but I didn't see any life vests strapped to the lifelines along the bow. I also didn't see any signals coming from this boat. I dropped down to 600 feet and continued north. At 6:46 p.m., I spotted another boat out the right front windshield. Its heading was due north, like mine. I flew by off its port side looking for the life jackets on the bow. I didn't see them. Just before the boat disappeared from view beneath my right wing, I caught a flash. Banking hard, I circled around. I was able to keep my eyes on the boat through the right window. I caught some more flashes. Dot, 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 dash. Morse code for V. After a brief pause, dot. Morse code for E. At this point, I was reasonably sure that I had found Tito's boat, with Sage and Manuel aboard. It was certainly possible that Sage had forgotten to put the Mae West vests on the forward railing, or possibly something had prevented her from putting the orange devices on the forward railing. I needed to be $300,000 sure before I pulled that release lever, though. I kept circling, waiting for more flashes. Finally, I saw dot, dash, dot, dot, Morse code for L. That was followed by dash, 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 Morse code for O. I broke off my pattern to line up behind the boat for the drop, but saw that the flashes continued to spell L-O-V-E. At 400 feet, I lined up on the stern of the boat. My airspeed was still 135 miles an hour. Not bad for a drop. As the boat disappeared beneath the nose of Pegasus, I reached for the release lever and, brats, I forgot about the tape wrapped around the release lever. Since I wanted to drop the life ring package as close as possible, I circled around and lined up again. This time with the tape removed, I pulled the release lever as soon as their boat disappeared beneath the nose of Pegasus. I banked left, then quickly right. I was able to see the orange life ring package deploy its small drogue chute. It passed over the fishing boat and dropped into the Atlantic Ocean. The bundle floated about 100 yards in front of the fishing boat. I continued to circle as the boat steamed towards the package. The boat slowed. A long hook was lowered into the water, and the bundle was brought aboard. A moment of dread filled my mind. What if, by some incredible coincidence, I had dropped the package for a fishing boat that just happened to flash L-O-V-E to me? I mean, the odds were low, but there was $300,000 and the safety of Sage riding on it. All I could make out were people dressed in black retrieving the package. I tried to convince myself that I could recognize Sage or Manuel, but I could not be sure. My pulse remained fast. Then the ham radio came to life. I listened to the dots and dashes and decoded them as I continued to circle. L-O-V-E. Y-O-U. I was at once relieved and stunned. Sage loved me? It was quicker for me to simply wag my wings than to send a Morse code. I circled one more time and kept my gaze on the fishing boat. A figure dressed in black, with a blonde ponytail flowing from under her hat, came out from the cabin. It had to be Sage. She waved enthusiastically. I knew then that I had dropped the package to the right boat. Manuel expected me to fly home after making the drop, so I initially continued on a northwest course. I climbed back up to 800 feet and flew a long arcing course west of Cotton Key. I then flew north of the tiny island and headed due east. I had 5 hours to kill. I planned to fly east over an empty Atlantic Ocean and back. Initially, I would fly an hour east and an hour back. As midnight approached, I would shorten the trips, remaining near Cotton Key. I didn't want to be far from the exchange as midnight drew near. With the first major hurdle of the mission cleared, I relaxed a bit. The air was a bit cooler, so I closed the window and put on my headphones. Switching to an AM radio station out of Cuba, I tuned in some Cuban jazz. I didn't recognize the artist, but I enjoyed the music. With the last rays of twilight, I once again eased from my seat to stretch. I could keep my eyes on the horizon and jump back behind the controls if necessary. Once night came, this was much more difficult over the ocean. After sunset, I fly using the artificial horizon on my instrument panel. I took advantage of the last minutes of daylight to pet Cargo and feed him some water. I ate another sandwich, drank some water, and relieved myself for the first time since I had taken off 7 hours earlier. Feeling refreshed, I returned to my seat and put my headphones back on. The Cuban jazz was still playing on the radio. I knew there was still a tailwind, so an hour east would likely require an hour and 15 minutes west, maybe more. I was still flying at just 135 miles an hour, though, so I could pick up the pace if I needed to. I listened to the music, held a steady course, and pondered why Sage had sent the message, "Love you," on the ham radio. Sage could not have thought
that I needed extra motivation to complete this mission. So I thought she must have actually meant that she loved me. On the other hand, if I understood women, I would probably not still be a bachelor. End of chapter 6. Chapter 7. Once the sun set, flying required more concentration. I had to spend more time focusing on my artificial horizon. I could see stars, but the line between water and sky was indiscernible. The added workload helped to keep me awake. After half an hour, the AM radio station faded away. I took off the headphones and opened the window back up for some fresh air. I could see some phosphorescent glow on the surface of the water. Off in the distance, I could see a freighter on a southerly course. At 9 o'clock, I checked the ham radio and heard the expected silence. After listening for a signal for a couple of minutes, I turned Pegasus around and headed back to a spot in the ocean 20 miles or so north of Cotton Key. As I approached the vicinity of Cotton Key, Cuban jazz came back into my headphones. My eyes were adjusting to the darkness, and the full moon was clearly visible above the horizon. I was flying without any lights, so I decided to fly wide circles around Cotton Key, rather than flying out over the Atlantic and back. If I flew a 20-mile radius, quick math suggested I would pass the same spot every half hour. That would be unlikely to raise too much suspicion, I decided. Before I began flying circles, I checked the ham radio for a 10 o'clock message. I listened for several minutes, but heard only silence. Flying a circle requires more concentration than a straight line. That was not all bad, as I was working to stay awake. Flying a circle requires more concentration than a straight line. That wasn't all bad, as I was working to stay awake. I spotted Cotton Key and Salt Key way off to my left. I decided to switch my circle to clockwise so I could watch the island out of my right window. I kept the islands in view just over the right wing. Once the islands moved behind the wing, I would bank slightly right. My first circle took me 40 minutes. I started my second circle, edging closer to the island. I turned off the AM radio and left the ham radio playing in my headphones. All I heard was static. I assumed no news was good news. At 11 o'clock, I was northbound, west of Cotton Key. I still heard silence on the radio. I decided to change my pattern and begin north-south passes 10 miles west of Cotton Key. This would keep me less than 10 minutes from the island as the midnight hour approached. I studied the night sky. The moon was high in the sky. It was bright enough that I could just make out the tops of some waves as well as the islands. To the north, Polaris, the North Star, was quickly found. The Big Dipper was located to the left and below Polaris. As I approached Cotton Key, observing these constellations would help keep me oriented. 10 minutes before midnight, the radio was still silent. I was 10 miles west of Cotton Key and 20 miles south of the island. I reversed course and headed toward the island. I slowed Pegasus more, down to just 125 miles an hour. I strained to see the lights of the fishing boats I hoped were parked offshore, but I couldn't see any lights. I assumed they were running dark. I started flying an S-shaped pattern. I wanted to approach the island as slowly as possible. If I flew past and kept circling, the salvage crew might get suspicious. I did a circle while I was still 15 miles out. I did another circle while I was 10 miles from the island. Midnight arrived. I crept to within 5 miles of the island. I thought I could make out the fishing craft, anchored off the eastern coast of the tiny island, but I could not be sure. If I was looking at the fishing boats, neither one had their navigation lights on. Of course, neither did I. I prepared for what I expected to be a rough landing. I reached down on both sides of my seat and grabbed my typically unused seat belt. I buckled the belt and pulled it in tight. I was a couple of miles from Cotton Key when I noticed a dim light on the island. The light was moving. It was a flashlight. I heard nothing over the radio, but I detected a pattern to the movement of the light. Dot, 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 dot. Pause. Dot. Pause. Dot dash. That was all I needed to see. H-E-A. I left the throttles alone. It was critical not to thermally stress the engines, but putting the nose down and diving toward the ocean allowed me to pick up some airspeed. I strained to find the outline of the entire island in the moonlit night. I looked up at the Big Dipper and the North Star. Then I looked down and found the beach I wanted to land on, one end illuminated with a flashlight moving from sand to trees and back to sand. I slowed down to 80 miles an hour, put the landing gear down, and aimed just to the left of the flashlight. Pegasus drifted to the right. I realized I would need to land in a crosswind. Landing in a crosswind with a DC-3 is difficult. Landing at night on an unlit field is difficult, and I would only attempt it with a full moon. The only previous landings I had done at night
or into fields that I was familiar with. In order to save Sage, I needed to land in a crosswind, at night, onto a beach I had never landed on. Suddenly, I had no difficulty pushing thoughts of Sage's love from my mind. I was fully focused on the job at hand. I was fully focused on self-preservation. I lowered my left wing and fed in some right rudder. This slipped the plane in against the crosswind that was blowing left to right. Slipping a plane made it go sideways to the direction of travel, much like a car that is power sliding. It let the plane take a direct path to the runway, while allowing it to bleed off speed. I reached up and turned on my landing lights. They pointed the way my plane was pointing, to the right. The only thing lit up by the landing lights was water. Normally, just as the wheels touched, it would be necessary to straighten the rudder, but keep the upwind wing low to prevent the plane from being flipped by the crosswind. However, trees lined the upwind side of this beach, so I expected the crosswind to fade as soon as I got to treetop level. It was my hope I could set down with both wheels. Fortunately, I was prepared for the crosswind to disappear when I got to treetop level. Pegasus suddenly veered towards the trees, but I instantly leveled the wings and straightened the rudder. With a soft thud, I hit the beach. The sand cushioned the impact. Pegasus bounded once, then settled into the sand and rapidly slowed down. Now my landing lights lit up the narrow, curving strip of beach before me. I pulled back on the control yoke to keep the nose from going into the sand. The beach was a bit softer than I had expected, and it slowed the plane down rapidly. I fed in right rudder to ease the plane along the curve of the shore, remaining focused on the shoreline where the waves met the sand. As the plane slowed, the tail dropped and the nose pointed up. As the nose pointed up, the landing lights did too. I could only see a vague edge of the tree line to my left and moonlit beach line to my right. I went more by feel than vision at this point, continuing the gentle curved path that I'd been on before the tail of the plane dropped. Finally, Pegasus came to a complete stop. I stuck my head out the window and looked down. My right wheel was in and out of the waterline as waves washed up on shore. I pressed hard with my left toe, locking the left wheel, and spun the plane around. The top of the tree line was lit up as the nose swung around, and the landing light shined up high on the trees. I looked back over my right shoulder to orient myself to the Big Dipper and Polaris. I kept my head out of the window to get the best view of the tree line, vaguely lit by the skyward pointing landing lights. As I approached the end of the beach, I saw the light of Sage's flashlight. I pulled the throttles back to idle and set the brakes. I switched off the landing lights and grabbed my 1911 and ran down the carpet to the cargo door. Cargo was awake now and followed me down the carpet. I swung the door open and dropped the steps. It was dark, but the moon provided enough light to make out the beach, the waves, and two boats offshore. They were each moving now, approaching each other offshore. It was then that I saw some flashes coming from the boats. The popping sound I heard told me they were gunshots. I didn't think they would be able to hit me from a mile away, but it meant we did not have much time. It also meant that, perhaps, Manuel should not have trusted his salvage friends. Cargo had beaten me down the stairs. He was happy to be on solid ground and took the opportunity to relieve himself. Sage ran around the tail of the aircraft, flashlight wildly swinging as she ran. I kept a tight grip on my 1911. While I could not imagine how it could be anyone but Sage, a sliver of doubt remained. Until I smelled her perfume, that is. Then she threw her arms around me. Yelling in my ear, she said, "I'm so glad to see you. Come on." With that, she turned and ran back down the beach, behind the tail of the plane. I followed after her, still aware of occasional flashes from the boats offshore. Cargo followed. 100 feet up the beach, some bags were visible. They looked like a pile of large stones in the moonlight. We were halfway there when cargo dashed ahead of us. A lone figure carrying 2 bags was trying to make it to the tree line. Weighed down by 2 40-pound bags of coins, he was quickly overtaken by cargo. I motioned for Sage to continue toward the pile on the beach. I followed cargo and caught up with him in time to see a fellow dressed in black. He was laying on his left side, with his right forearm firmly in cargo's grasp. A bag of coins lay on either side of him. The fellow was screaming. Cargo was growling. Both were loud enough to be clearly audible over the idling radials of Pegasus. As I approached the struggling pair, I saw a reflection in the moonlight. The figure was fumbling with a chrome-colored object. I knew what that had to be. I reached them just as he drew the revolver and pointed it at Cargo. I stood to Cargo's left, behind the figure's back. I pointed my 1911 at his head. "Kill the dog, and I kill you," I said in a loud command voice. Everyone froze. All I heard now was Cargo's low growl. After eternity had passed, at least 5 seconds, the figure spoke.
Get the dog off me.
Toss the gun first, I said. The figure was in a tough spot. He couldn't quite reach far enough around to point the gun at me. Cargo had him firmly in his grasp. And, if he shot Cargo, I shot him. It would appear the figure and I had something in common, a general aversion to gunplay. We dealt in goods and services. Guns were just an occasional, sometimes necessary, last resort. He tossed his gun a few feet away. With my 1911 still trained on his head, I moved around him to pick the revolver up. It was a large caliber Smith & Wesson. I was familiar with the big Smith revolvers. I was able to release the cylinder catch and empty it. I was grateful that he had not hurt Cargo. I told him, I will leave your gun on the beach when I take off. When I called off Cargo as I stepped away, my 1911 now pointed at his chest, I slipped his gun in my pants pocket.
You're stealing from us,
the figure shouted. No, I explained. Payment is being made offshore. We're just making sure the deal is completed. My apologies if you didn't plan on going through with it. The figure stood up. I wanted him off my runway. I didn't want him to make a move for me. I pulled the trigger on my 1911. My plan had been to put a bullet into the sand beneath his feet and scare him. Most people take off running when someone is shooting at them. But my aim was a little high. The bullet passed between his legs, causing him to jump up in the air like he was doing jumping jacks. The figure let out a yelp that was an octave or so higher than anything he had said so far. When his feet touched the sand again, he turned and fled into the tree line. I picked up one bag with my left hand. After a bit of adjustment, I was able to pick up the other bag with my right hand while still holding my 1911. I could drop the bag in an instant and be ready for any additional threats. Sage was on her way back from the plane to retrieve additional coins. I glanced at the pile. There were only 2 bags left. I started toward the plane, scanning the horizon for additional figures. Sage grabbed the remaining 2 bags and followed me. I felt vulnerable carrying the coins. The fastest pace I could manage was a brisk walk. I could not run. Cargo followed along next to me. It was a long 30 seconds. When I reached the cargo door of Pegasus, I was shaking. Shaking from the adrenaline of a gunfight. Shaking from carrying 2 heavy bags of coins. Shaking from fatigue. Exhaustion met anxiety, and the result was mostly shaking. I set the bags on the steps and motioned for Cargo to get up into the plane. Sage arrived as I tossed my bags up onto the cargo floor. She handed me 1 bag, which I tossed into the plane. Sage grabbed my lapel with her left hand. Pointing with her right hand down the beach, she yelled, over the sound of the engines, that one of the bags had broken. Then she turned to head up the beach and retrieve the dropped coins. My internal alarm clock had just gone off. It was time to get off this island. Clearly the salvage crew had not actually planned on parting with their treasure. I was rather surprised they had left only 1 behind on the island. Obviously they underestimated Sage. Obviously they had underestimated our team. The most important thing I had come to this island for was still in my grasp, and I wasn't going to let her go. With a firm hold on her shirt, I held her back. She looked at me. I shook my head, no, and pointed up the stairs. Sage hesitated, but my firm grasp was already getting her moving in that direction. She took my direction and scrambled up the steps. I was right behind her. As I made my way up the steps, the heavy weight of that revolver reminded me it was in my pocket. I didn't want it anyway. The revolver was sent flying out the cargo door before I pulled up the steps. Slamming the cargo door closed, I sprinted up the carpet into the cockpit. Sage arrived at the cockpit after me and climbed into the pilot's seat. I was relieved to find no warning lights. Both engines were still idling along. Come on, Pegasus, I thought. You can do it. I was back in my office. I was back in my comfort zone. Now all I had to do was get us home. End of Chapter 7. Chapter 8. I pivoted Pegasus around to face north up the beach again. I found the Big Dipper and Polaris as reference. I stuck my head out the window to look down at the shoreline of the beach. Satisfied that I was lined up well enough, I advanced the throttles all the way to 52 inches of mercury, max power for takeoff. The tail quickly rose, and I flipped on the landing lights to see how I was lining up with my makeshift runway. An eyeful of trees told me I was too far left. I corrected firmly to the right with rudder only. No brakes. I still had 400 gallons of fuel on board. On most missions, it would have been a full fuel load. The weight of the fuel and soft sand were making Pegasus struggle a bit to get in the air. The beach was narrowing. A jolt went through the plane as my right wheel struck a rut at the edge of the water. The plane nosed down slightly and spun to the right, putting my right wheel deeper into the ocean. I knew if I couldn't save this quickly, we would all, too literally, be dead in the water. I gave Pegasus hard left rudder and turned the yoke to the left, hoping I had enough speed to lift the right wing up. My right wheel was now skipping on the water. My left wheel was riding on the beach. The shoreline was passing right under my nose. I was running out of time. I deployed some flaps, and Pegasus shook free of the ground, barely traveling fast enough to stay airborne. I eased her over the ocean, gently handling the controls. I caught some more flashes out the window on my right. I slowly returned the flaps back to normal position and climbed up to 600 feet. Pegasus was now flying 140 miles an hour. I could ease back on the throttles. I pulled up the landing gear, and the plane began to pull right, harder and harder. I thought of the cliche, if it hurts, don't do it. I pushed hard on the left rudder pedal while I put the landing gear back down. Steadily, the plane straightened out again. I did not, however, get the light on the dashboard telling me the gear was down. That could pose a problem when I landed, but that was still 6 hours away. With the landing gear down, Pegasus would use more fuel than usual. Off the top of my head, I didn't know how much more, but the landing gear created a lot of drag. To offset the drag, I slowed the plane down to just 120 miles an hour. Even with a slight headwind, I should cross the Florida Keys around 5 o'clock in the morning at this rate. As long as I passed between a couple of the keys before sunrise, I could take a much more direct route to the Everglades. I wouldn't have to fly all the way around the keys as I had during daylight. I pointed Pegasus nearly due west. Once in the open space of ocean between the Bahamas and Cuba, I would turn west-northwest and fly directly to the Everglades, over the keys. I pumped the last of the fuel left in my cabin tanks into the wing tanks. Finally, there was nothing to do but fly for a while. I looked over at Sage. I could see her face in the glow from the gauges. She wasn't moving. Her eyes were fixed on me. I didn't want to tell Sage about the landing gear. There was nothing she could do about it. On the other hand, it was too early to celebrate. I decided to give her a job. I could work the radio direction finder, but teaching her to work it would pass some time and keep her mind occupied. After showing her how to work it, I asked for updates on the heading to Miami's radio tower every 5 minutes. I didn't actually need this info. I knew these waters like the back of my hand. I made it seem very important, though. It kept me from discussing what I was really worried about, the landing gear. Actually, I was worried about two things, the landing gear and fuel. I just didn't know how much I had on board now. I had been flying for 12 hours. Flying slowly, I planned to use 90 gallons per hour or less. I should have had enough for 5 more hours, if my landing gear wasn't acting as an air brake, but it was. I had to hope my slow airspeeds had conserved enough fuel. I also needed clear skies over the farmer's field when I arrived. I became aware of the aches and pains from the long mission. My legs and back were stiff and sore from sitting in one position for too long. My arms ached from carrying heavy bags of coins and tossing them into the plane. With no urgent matters to address, it was becoming difficult to stay awake. I listened to the pulsating rhythm of the engines. I began to nod off to sleep. Sage noticed my difficulty staying awake. Slipping out of the pilot's chair, she stepped behind me and began to massage my shoulders and neck. The flow of electricity returned, along with a new burst of energy. I kept my gaze forward, but touched her hands in thanks. I began to operate the radio direction finder. Having told her it was that critical, I had to keep up the ruse, but I didn't want Sage to stop keeping me awake. I wanted to talk to Sage about us. Conversation in a DC-3 cockpit is not easy, however. It takes a loud voice to speak over the engines when flying. I also needed to concentrate for another few hours. If the conversation didn't go in the direction I wanted, it would make saving our lives much more difficult. So I settled for a neck rub and the scent of her perfume that I couldn't identify. I kept the Big Dipper out the right front window. It was easier than staring at the compass. By the time we crossed over the Florida Keys, Sage had returned to the pilot seat and dozed off. I looked over at Cargo. He was asleep behind her seat. I envied Cargo. He was completely at peace. The moon had set. The sun was getting ready to rise. It was very dark. I focused on the artificial horizon mounted in front of me. It was nearly 6 o'clock in the morning as I turned north over the Everglades. The stars disappeared as twilight began. My timing was nearly perfect. Then I saw the fog. All I saw were wisps at first, but as the sun continued to rise, I could see more clearly that I could not see clearly. The swamplands below me were cloaked in a blanket of puffy white mist. There were no visual references on the ground, only the horizon. Now I actually had a need for the radio direction finder. I had Sage tune in the North Perry Airport beacon. Using the compass, I kept a due north heading. I knew when the North Perry Beacon was 45 degrees off to my right that I should be approaching the farmer's field.
21 degrees,
Sage shouted above the engines. I knew the sun would burn off the fog. I didn't know if I had enough fuel to wait. Flying back with the gear down threw my fuel calculations out the window. All I knew for sure was that both engines were still running right now, and I wanted them both running when I tried to put my wounded bird into the farmer's field.
35 degrees.
The time was approaching 6:30 in the morning. The sun had not fully risen yet, but it was now easy to see in the early twilight. The cloud below me was well illuminated.
45 degrees.
I looked over at Sage. She looked tense. Her eyes scanned the view out the windshield, the radio direction finder, and my face. She spent most of the time staring at me. I put on my seatbelt and motioned for her to do the same. Up ahead, I could see the fog beginning to break up. I could make out roads. Cars were still driving with their headlights on. I knew my farmer's field was not far from the first major road north of the Everglades, U.S. 41. I turned west, flying parallel to U.S. 41. The road turned northwest, exactly 6 miles from the farmer's field. Even better, if I flew from the turn on U.S. 41 directly towards the North Perry Beacon, I would fly over the field. The 45-degree turn on U.S. 41 was unmistakable from the air. I knew exactly where I was now. I turned directly over it and headed for North Perry. My airspeed was 120 miles an hour. That made the math easy. I was covering exactly 2 miles per minute. I would be over my field in 3 minutes. Sage gave me time updates every 30 seconds. 2.5 minutes from the turn, I slowed my airspeed to 80 miles an hour and started down into the fog. I could now see treetops. They marked the outlines of distinct fields, rectangles that stood in stark contrast to nature's forms. I had to trust my math that I was headed for the right one. The closer I got to the ground, the more I could see. The treetops became quite clear. As I cleared the near tree line, I recognized a unique swale in the northeast corner of the field. I had found the right field. All I had to do now was land. I had no idea what the condition of my right landing gear was. All I knew was that it did not come up when requested. I assumed it was also the reason my landing gear light did not indicate the gear had locked down. That was a rather big assumption. If I guessed wrong, what I was about to do would be disastrous. My plan was to dip the left wing as I touched down, keeping the plane on the good wheel as long as possible, before dropping the right wing and touching down with both wheels. If I was right, this would make any collapse of the right gear a slower speed event. If I was wrong, the left gear would collapse at 80 miles an hour. I didn't want to think about that. I applied the flaps. The left gear struck the dirt. The landing was a bit hard, not my best, but the gear held, however. I applied right rudder to keep the plane from turning left. I had to bleed off speed slowly to keep from ground looping or spinning out. I felt like I was riding a strangely shaped unicycle. Every control input was moving at the same time. At a speed of about 45 miles an hour or so, I was no longer able to keep the right wing up. The wings were level, but only briefly. Then a loud bang announced the right landing gear giving way. The right wing tip dropped to the dirt as the plane turned hard right. I applied full left rudder, but there was not much I could do to stop it. The sudden right turn brought the right wing back up, and Pegasus smacked her left wing to the ground. The tail rose, and for the first time this morning, we could see the ground very clearly. I heard wind chimes, such a strange sound to hear in the middle of a crash landing. Then the tail dropped back to the ground. Silence. Both props had struck the ground, stalling both engines. I reached up and turned off the fuel pumps and generators. I shut down all systems. Dust slowly settled outside the aircraft, revealing a clear view of the field for 100 feet or so before fog obscured it. I looked back to see how Cargo had fared in the hard landing. He was standing, his tail wagging. The padded doggy bed had done its job. Relieved that the plane and the dog had both survived, I turned my attention to Sage. She was still just looking at me. We were in a state of shock. 18 hours of nonstop tension, and then silence. Then the laughter began. Full belly, uncontrollable laughter. The tension was flowing from our bodies. Sage and I unbuckled and climbed from our seats. We looked each other over for any cuts or bruises. Then we embraced. We kissed. I felt the firm muscles of her strong back in my arms. Her perfume mixed with the smells of oil inside Pegasus. Cargo pressed his nose between us. Sage and I both bent down to pet my faithful companion. Cargo's actions on this trip likely saved a life. Without Cargo, either I would have shot the figure on the beach, or the figure would have shot me. After the tension flowed, the exhaustion began to settle in. We sat on the floor of the cockpit and discovered the source of the wind chimes. Silver coins. They were everywhere. We never had thought to secure the payload after tossing it on board. One of the bags had broken open, and antique silver coins were strewn about the cockpit. The coins reminded me the mission was not yet finished. We still had work to do. Sage began collecting the loose silver coins, while I set about restoring my tail number. Fortunately, the metal cans in back were still well secured. I retrieved the can of alcohol, a bucket, and a fresh mop head. It was a long way down from the steps to the ground. The plane's left landing gear was standing tall, but her right gear was buckled. This left the cargo door pointing a bit skyward. I lowered the can of alcohol down to the ground with a rope. I tossed the mop and bucket, then carefully scrambled down. In just a few minutes, the familiar N6937 was clearly visible on the tail. The fog was lifting now. I felt relief anyone noticing the wounded bird on the field would see the tail numbers visible. Explaining this to an FAA investigator would be difficult. Obscuring the tail numbers? Impossible. Repairs to Pegasus could come later, but before I could have Jake come out and work on her, we needed to get those coins somewhere else. I scrambled back into the plane. Sage had gathered up the loose coins and put them into my gear bag. I could take the Indian Scout to my apartment and pick up my truck, but first, I had to get it out of the plane. I told Sage to take a seat and went forward. I made sure Cargo was laying down in his bed. Then I raised the landing gear. The good left wheel collapsed into the wing. Pegasus fell flat to the ground with a thump. Now getting the motorcycle out would be easy. Sage and I carried the bags of coins well into the tree line, just in case the crippled airplane attracted any attention. No one had ever arrived unexpected before, but we had $1 million riding on this not being the first time. Besides, I'd never put Pegasus on her belly in the field before. With the plane on the ground, unloading the Scout was easy. It ran well on aviation fuel. Soon I was on the road. It was hard to leave Sage and Cargo behind. Money came and went. Special companions like Sage and Cargo were hard to replace. Every fiber of my being wanted to open up the bike and race back to the apartment, but attracting attention in my business is a bad idea. I drove 2 miles per hour over the speed limit. My heart pounded as I passed a police car on US 41. I wanted to look away, but that makes you look guilty. I watched the car pass by. I wondered if they were on the way to the field. An hour and a half later, I pulled into the farmer's field with Sage's Cadillac. I figured it would be better to stash the coins in a car's trunk than leave them open in the back of my truck. It was a practical choice, but I have to admit the ride was also very nice. I was relieved to learn that the police car I had seen a couple miles up the road did not stop by the field. As far as I could tell, the rough landing had attracted no attention. We loaded up the coins and headed for my apartment. End of chapter 8. Chapter 9. It was a few days before I got around to telling Jake that Pegasus needed repair. No one had noticed the DC-3 sitting in the remote field, so there was no real hurry. I told Jake I needed a big favor. I explained I'd taken a couple on a fishing expedition up to Michigan. The 2,700-mile trip explained the many hours in the air. I explained that the fog I encountered returning had disoriented me, and I'd put down in a field as I ran out of gas. I told him how much damage I thought had been done, and I told him that money was no object. My clients were willing to pay for all damages, I explained. Jake could take as long as he wanted with the repairs. I just wanted her airworthy again, with no official reports. I don't really think he believed the whole story, but Jake assured me he would have Pegasus airworthy again in a couple of weeks. From the airport, Cargo and I headed east to Fort Lauderdale. I thought about Manuel as the warm Florida air blew through the open windows of my Chevy truck. There had been no word from him after the mission. There had been no word from Tito either. I never met Tito, but I mourned his loss more than Manuel's. On my way to the marina, I bought some groceries. I picked up a case of Ballantine Ale. I also bought a copy of the Miami News. Ever since the mission, we had read the papers daily looking for relevant news. Cargo and I stepped aboard Second Chance, Sage's 48-foot wooden sloop. I settled into a comfortable place in the cockpit and opened the paper. On page 2 was the news I was looking for. The headline read, "Storms Uncover Buried Treasure on Remote Caribbean Island." "Hey, Sage," I called down to the cabin. "Remember those coins we left behind on the beach?" End of chapter 9. This has been Smuggler's Grift, written by B.Z. Kelly, narrated by B.Z. Kelly, copyright 2014, B.Z. Kelly. This audio production was completed in 2016.